Working Class Heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. I'm going to be talking about the assault on workers that continues thanks to our Republican friends, not only here in Pennsylvania, but across the country. Talk about that. Also, Obamacare, or the dreaded Obamacare. And, of course, the Obama pen. And the phone, too. Yes, some information. The pen will be in use. Also, we're going to talk about brown bags and lazy black guys. Thanks, Paul Ryan. I got to be honest. All of the work that the Republican Party has done in outreach to the minority community, congratulations. In 2 days, you mucked that up right away. Lost. Good. Done. Bye. And look, I don't really think the Republicans ever really wanted to be the party of the big tent. They just wanted to appear that way. Because maybe you quell people not to get angry and not to go out and vote against you. And that's really the plot there. Not that they care about how to make the inner cities better. Not that they care about policies. No, it's easy just to throw bombs. Also going to talk about who's buying up the foreclosed homes. We see a lot of some recent news of all cash sales. Almost half of all the homes being purchased are with all cash. Who's got all this cash? I know it's not me. I know it's none of the people I know. So who is it? We'll find out about that. So much to get to today. It is an interesting day news-wise. The plane, now they think they have an idea where the plane is from Malaysia. So it'll be interesting to follow that as well. Your questions, your thoughts, your comments, whatever's on your mind. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So the petitions are in. Yesterday was the end of getting your petition signed if you want to run for office. And the folks who are throwing their hat into the ring, well, you better have your T's crossed, your I's dotted, and, well, I better not have any Mickey Mouses or Donald Ducks on your registration forms, on your petitions. One gubernatorial candidate didn't quite make it, of which I got to be honest, was not surprised. But the Lebanon County Commissioner, Jo Ellen Litz, she didn't come up with enough petition signatures. Now, is it that, you know, people in her office just didn't get them there? You know, it was a little late. You know, we're running behind traffic. Or is it that she just couldn't get the necessary 2,000 signatures? What you think about 2,000 signatures doesn't sound like that many in a state of 12 million people. So, you know, it is what it is. The interesting part of it, though, is that you have to have at least 100 signatures from each of 10 different counties. Which means that you have to have some broad-based support, which I think is actually good. Now, there are those who want to read into this what you know, so-and-so got more signatures. Allison Schwartz led this signature getting. She got 22,000 signatures from 34 counties. Rob McCord collected 13,000 signatures from all 61 counties. So you got to give credit there. Tom Wolf had more than 12,000 signatures from more than 50 counties, according to the latest reports. John Hanger, over 5,000 from 40 counties. Katie McGinty, over 5,000 from 40 counties. Jack Wagner, they claim, made this filing. No numbers yet what they were, but Wagner got in there under the gun. Litz, not so much. So she will not be on the ballot unless she decides to run in a write-in campaign, and then good luck on that. She had about as much chance of running a write-in campaign as she did of actually getting on the ballot. Now, I look at this, and I go, okay, well, you know, Allison Schwartz, all the Schwartz people are going, yay, look at her. She got 22,000 signatures. But you look at it between Cawley and Corbett, they got 50,000. And I understand the big money's behind them right now. They've got the institutional Republican Party money. And the entire party machinery behind them. So you didn't see Tom Corbett out there going, can I have your signature, please? You didn't see that. You didn't see Tom knocking on doors. Jim Cawley was not knocking on anyone's door begging for their signature. It was not happening. So the Schwartz people are saying, we won, we got 22,000. The McCord people are saying, hey, we were in every county. It will be interesting to see how this all shakes out. I don't foresee there being any one thrown off the ballot because they didn't get enough signatures. Now, that may not be the case on the lieutenant governor's side, of which Senator Mike Stack ended up with over close to 10,000 signatures. Brad Kaplinski, the guy from Harrisburg, the city councilman, over 6,000. Mark Kritz, the former congressman from out west, somewhere 3,800 from 25 counties. Representative Brandon Newman, over somewhere around 2,500. Mark Smith, the county commissioner, somewhere around 2,000. Now, Jay Paterno, because you had to have 1,000 signatures. Jay Paterno evidently has, well, the way this is being reported by the people over at Politics PA, somewhere around 1,100. So the report has been that there's already somebody, they don't know who it is, who the lieutenant governor candidate is, somebody's already hired an attorney to challenge those. So it will be interesting to see how that plays itself out if he gets left off the ballot. What I did find interesting is Brenda Alton will be firing somebody because, according to the report that I saw, they had the signatures, just didn't make it in by 5 o'clock. So, you know, you kind of wonder, fired, yes, maybe, I don't know. Definitely no bonus. Definitely nothing there for them. But, you know, I look at this and, you know, understand, this is an exciting, to me, elections are exciting. It's exciting to talk about what the possible is. Because if you look at right now, look at what's going on in our Commonwealth right now. Look at the direction our state has gone. We have gone from a good job creation state with a fairly strong economy, with a good education system, both at the K-12 and the higher ed levels. We did a reasonable job. I'm not saying a great job, but a reasonable job of taking care of our neighbors and making sure the least among us at least are somewhat cared for to a state right now that's struggling. No matter how you look at it, we're somewhere between 46th and 48th, depending on whose survey you're looking at. But either way, 46th or 48th is not 7th. And when the governor took office, we were 7th. And we had just come from a pretty sizable, major Republican-led recession. When you get the Bush collapse happening, and we were coming out of it when he took over, he brought his policies in, which really just stifled all growth. Under the guise of, well, we got to make things right. And now he's running around saying that, well, you know, we fixed the budget. Not so much. You created huge problems down the line. And the question then becomes, and this is one of those things where you just gotta have some measure of thoughtfulness. As we cut education spending for today, as we cut my kids' opportunity to go to good quality education, what happens to them in the years that follow? You know, nobody's going to really chart this stuff. We're not going to be able to look back in 25 years and go, you know what? All of our kids are behind everybody else because we didn't invest in their education, but they're going to have lower opportunities. That's reality. And it comes back down to this tip-of-the-nose politic, this tip-of-the-nose that, oh, well, we balance the budget off of who's back. And you look at the budgets. Where have the priorities been? Well, the priorities obviously have been for this sitting governor, tax breaks for big corporations, not taxing the people who are taking the resources out from under our feet, not really regulating what they're doing, and really kind of just this idea of privatize, and then blinding us with their failures. Failure after failure, the voter suppression. I guess you could make the argument that they're less bad than the Walkers and the Kasichs and the Snyders and the Scotts. Maybe you could make an argument that Corbett has been less bad. But the reality is all the same ugliness that went on in Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan and those places coming here. And as we speak, you know, there's a number of pieces of legislation that are bing-banging around in the halls of our General Assembly that are just horrible for the state, horrible for working people, horrible for families. The whole push towards privatizing our education system is monumentally destructive. Yet you've got those who, because, hey, the guy's got an R behind his name, we're jumping on board. And anybody who's listened to this program any longer than 10 minutes knows I beat up on Democrats equally because if they don't know better, we're going to teach them. Privatizing education to me is a non-starter. It makes no sense. Privatization as a whole at this point, after 30 years of experimentation, after 30 years of failure after failure, rising costs, less service, at some point you got to say what is. And then we stop it. And that's, to me, what these elections are about. This is a vetting period for who's going to be the guy who's got the ideas who are going to take us to tomorrow to make sure that someone's got my kids' future at heart. Now, we could go through each of the candidates, and everybody's got their favorite. I've got a bunch of mine, and that's why we play this game. And the signature game is one of the first things that you play. Who got the most signatures? Who got them from where? How do you rouse your base? That's what politics is supposed to be about. It's not about who's got the most money, or it shouldn't be about who has the most money. It should be who's got people energized. And, you know, I look at the Corbett plan, a lot of money going into that. I didn't see an awful lot of enthusiasm within the party faithful. Now you've got your party flacks that are paid for, like the Teresa Myers that I'm going to reach out here in the coming days to talk about that hack piece she had over at the Sentinel. You're always going to have them, but the average everyday rank and file Republican is looking at the party with a jaundiced eye and lots of questions because they're struggling just like everybody else. And in that vein, I got to be honest, I found it surprising. That Schuster, the congressman, my former congressman, Bill Schuster, the ninth district congressman here from Pennsylvania, whose father was the asphalt king and that held that ninth district seat for, I don't know, a couple of generations at least. Schuster's now got three Republican challengers here in the primary who have met their signature number. So you're going to have a tea partier, and you're just going to have a whole bunch of Republicans in the field going after the good congressman who, you know, I got to be honest, I would love to see gone, just not to somebody who's crazier. I don't want to see the party go any further to the extreme. Or maybe I do, honestly, because maybe that's the only way that eventually they come back to sanity. And I do understand that in the ninth, there is going to be a woman who, I think I met her at the Keystone Progress Summit a couple of weekends ago, Alana Hartzog. She ran a couple of years ago against him as a Green Party candidate. I guess now she got the signatures. She's going to be on the ballot. I guess she's the co-director of the Earth Rights Institute. So we're going to reach out to those folks, see if they'll come out and talk to us about their run against one of my least favorite congressmen. Anyway, I've got to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to Win
Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
North America's building trades unions are urging immediate approval of the Keystone XL pipeline project. They say environmental and national security impacts have been adequately debated and addressed, and it's time to approve the pipeline and the estimated 42,100 jobs throughout the U.S. the unions say that it would create. Laborers Union President Terry O'Sullivan.
To the tens of thousands of men and women in the construction industry, this isn't just a pipeline. It's their mortgages, college tuitions, car payments, and food on the table. And for our country, this isn't just a pipeline. It's a lifeline to family security, energy security, and national security. The American people want to build the pipeline. Just last week, an ABC Washington Post poll showed 65% of Americans support it, and 85% believe Keystone will create a significant number of jobs. It's time to wring the politics out of Keystone XL pipeline and to make a decision based on the will of the people and based on the national interest of our great country.
The Sierra Club, the Natural Resources Defense Council, National Nurses United, and some Canadian unions are among those opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline. They say, according to the U.S. State Department, the pipeline would create 6,500 temporary construction jobs at most, and they say, according to TransCanada, the company building the pipeline, only hundreds of permanent jobs will be left when the pipeline is finished. A Cornell University study also says the pipeline would allegedly kill more jobs than it would create by cutting investment in the clean energy economy. National Nurses United says that pipeline would accelerate unhealthy climate change. Progress Missouri recently delivered nearly 7,000 handwritten letters opposing anti-union legislation known as Right to Work to Missouri House Speaker Tim Jones. Progress Missouri Executive Director Sean Nicholson explains why the group opposes what it calls the Right to Work for Less legislation it says will harm working families.
We are fighting back on the so-called Right to Work bills and on paycheck deception and other kinds of attacks because we know that this is about the entire middle class of Missouri and the kind of state that we want for our families and for the future. We know that states with so-called Right to Work laws have lower wages, have lower rates of insurance, have lower investments in education. And that's not the kind of state that we want for Missouri.
Nearly 3 years ago, Connecticut was the first state to legally guarantee paid sick days for workers. A new report on the paid sick day law from the Center on Economic and Policy Research shows it had little or no negative impact on businesses in the state. Senior economist and report co-author Dr. Eileen Applebaum says the sick days law hasn't imposed major burdens on businesses. She says rather than the job killer opponents said it would be, over three-quarters of employers reported a positive experience with the law.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price. All I want is to be left alone in my average home. But why do I always feel like I'm in the twilight zone? And I always feel like somebody's watching me.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therichsmithshow.com. So some not so good news today, as it appears that House Bill 1154 has passed the House. This again, one of those ALEC type pieces of legislation attacking workers' rights, attacking our right to collectively bargaining, attacking our right workers' rights to even exist and have some sort of a voice. So on this horrible day, we have asked our good friend Attorney Irwin Aronson to come explain what this means and, well, what we can do to stop it from going any further. Irwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here, Rick.
So explain this to me. Walk me through what 1154 would do for those folks who may not know what it is.
House Bill 1154 is yet one more time where the legislature is adopting a solution in search of a problem. Back in 1993, Pennsylvania did a really good thing. It amended the criminal law in this state to provide serious and meaningful penalties for stalking and to protect victims of stalking by making stalking into a crime. But the legislature at the same time, in its wisdom, recognized that people could not and must not be permitted to use the law to pervert or twist its true intent. So they adopted an exception to the anti-stalking statute criminality, and at the same time an exception to the then existing anti-harassment statutory framework as well. And that said, fundamentally, that protected federal conduct in the labor management relations concept would not be subject to these otherwise recognizable and appropriate criminal penalties. So they put in an exception to this new rule with respect to stalking, with respect to harassment, and indeed with respect to the use of something that the law refers to as weapons of mass destruction. So Representative Ron Miller of York County, who is a candidate for election to the state Senate in a wildly unnecessary special election this coming Tuesday,
right,
to fill a vacancy that was created when Senator Waugh resigned from the Senate and became the director of the Farm Show, was a chief sponsor of legislation to do away with that statutory exception that has Pennsylvania state law recognizing that things like picketing and handbilling and speaking out in the context of the labor management relationship would be eliminated, do away with the exception. It got a lot of attention back this past late summer and into the early fall. Indeed, at one point, I appeared on a show on PCN, Pennsylvania Cable Network,
right,
debating an official of the United States Chamber of Commerce, because the Chamber of Commerce had done another one of their phony studies. And it was done by some swag group in just phony baloney group in Washington. And once again, they decided to impose their out-of-state, out-of-town, big-money demands on us here in Pennsylvania. So I had this debate with a representative of the chamber on PCN, knowing indeed that this legislation was being considered as soon as today because of some activity in the legislature yesterday. I looked at that video again along with my class, my Union Leadership Academy class in labor law that I teach, and I watched that again, and we held our own. I thought we did okay. But today, Representative Miller, in an effort to show, I suspect, that he is every bit as right-wing, reactionary, lunatic, fringe, out of touch, out of reality, as his write-in opponent, a guy named Scott Walker, who runs a waste management company down in New York, forced this bill to a vote, and the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, after yesterday putting in a modest amendment that, imagine this, are you sitting down?
Yeah, I'm sitting down.
Yesterday, in anticipation of passing this today, they amended the bill that Representative Miller had pending to do away with this exemption to basically criminalize protected labor conduct, federally protected labor conduct. Amended the bill to add in an exception that said that it wouldn't apply to constitutionally protected activity. The Pennsylvania General Assembly had a vote last night in amending the bill that said, in effect, that they acknowledged that the Constitution of the United States might actually apply to us.
That's mighty big of them. So then let me ask you this then. If it identifies that as, you know, we're not going to infringe on someone's constitutional right, then what's the point of the bill?
Well, the point of the bill is that...
Because if I've got the right to picket, if I've got the right to go on strike, if I've got the right to do these things...
Well, those are not constitutional rights.
But it's federal...
Those are statutory rights. Those are rights that are guaranteed by the National Labor Relations Act as it's been interpreted. It's not guaranteed by the Constitution. But before we delve into that piece a little more, let me say to you and to our listeners something that is really very critical. When they put up that amendment to say that the Pennsylvania General Assembly acknowledges that it cannot make the exercise of our constitutional rights illegal, 73 members of the Pennsylvania General Assembly voted against that amendment.
Are you kidding me?
No. 73 people who raised their hand and took an oath that said that they will uphold, protect, and defend the laws of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and the United States and the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and the United States voted against a law that acknowledged that people who exercise their rights under the law, to the degree they're constitutionally protected, to the degree they have to do with free speech, free assembly. 73 members of the General Assembly voted against the recognition of our constitutional rights. I was so shocked when I heard that, that I literally had to go to the roll call vote and look at the names of people in Pennsylvania who are elected members of the General Assembly, who are being paid for by taxpayers, you know, those union members, those thugs, those goons, those guerrillas, voted against acknowledging the Constitution of the United States might apply.
Please tell me Stephen Bloom was one of them.
I can tell you beyond peradventure that Stephen Bloom was one of them.
But he's Mr. Constitutional. He's the guy, I've heard him say he carries the thing with him.
Well, he may carry it, but he doesn't use it as a piece of literature. He must use it as something in the nature of padding for his behind in his back pocket. Because, shockingly, Bloom was among that group of 70-odd people who voted against the Constitution being applied to people who are union members. So today, after the adoption of that amendment, the law still exempted protected conduct until they passed this bill that, if now passed in the Senate, will criminalize protected federal labor activity, refuses to in any way acknowledge that my clients and I, that most of our listeners, that all of us have a right to picket, have a right to point out publicly that somebody is cheating us, stealing our wages, stripping us of our benefits, denying us the right to organize and bargain collectively over wages or over hours or over terms and conditions of our work. And I'm telling you that today the House of Representatives in Pennsylvania decided that we in Pennsylvania are in the third world. It is a shock, it is a nightmare, and it's a shot across the bow. So it moves on to the Senate, and in the Senate, we're really very lucky. We might get a shot at trying to amend it. But remember, the guy who sponsored this legislation in the House is a candidate and is the hand-picked Republican candidate, no primary election, for this special election effort. And he's trying to show that he's every bit as right-wing as one of his Republican opponents, who's a write-in candidate in the special election, but who yesterday filed papers to be on the ballot in the primary to be Representative Miller's opponent in the fall for that same seat.
Let me ask you this, and move back on this, because, you know, I've had a number of conversations with people who they have bought the rhetoric, that the rhetoric is that, well, you know, we've heard stories, and you alluded to the Chamber of Commerce study that came out of some tinky tank in D.C. Of stuff that I already believe is illegal. This idea, and you alluded to the weapons of mass destruction. If it were in fact true that someone, during a labor dispute, were to say to somebody, "I'm going to blow this up with a nuclear bomb," not even if they could, but if they were to say that. Isn't that illegal?
Absolutely, it's illegal. Interestingly, you raise this question. When the Pennsylvania House Judiciary Committee held a public hearing on this legislation this past fall, one of the members of the committee, Representative Don Costa, who, before being a member of the General Assembly, had a career in law enforcement, asked the witnesses that appeared before that committee, and oh, by the way, there was only one witness that they invited to testify against the legislation who was permitted to testify, and that witness was Frank Snyder, the Pennsylvania FL-CIO, its Secretary-Treasurer. He was wildly disrupted by the chairman of the committee and not even permitted to say what his testimony contemplated. But when Representative Costa asked the advocates of this legislation what it was that they were complaining about that would be changed by the law, he reached the ineluctable conclusion and said it in the public hearing that there was nothing that any of these various witnesses, this hyperbolic drivel that they were offering up, nothing that wasn't already protected by the existing state of the law, not merely this weapons of mass destruction silliness. And when I looked at that tape of the video that that I mentioned from the PCN debate on which I appeared back in November, I can't tell you how many times the young man who was opposite me kept on making reference to weapons of mass destruction. And by the way, I neglected to mention this, but it's important. In the amendment they adopted yesterday that guaranteed a recognition of our constitutional rights, they didn't apply that amendment to the weapons of mass destruction language, only to the harassment and stalking language.
Hmm. Interesting.
So there is nothing that is protected better. There is no crime that didn't exist that exists if this law passes that would allow people to be prosecuted. If anybody needs, I mean, it's a sad and shocking tale, but if anybody needs any evidence that the existing criminal statutory framework is adequate, beyond adequate, that it clearly and specifically punishes this deleterious conduct of which is this legislation's advocates purport to speak, it's that the United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, an appointee of Democratic President Obama, caused there to be an indictment against the local union in Philadelphia for alleged extortionary and criminal conduct just a few weeks ago.
Right.
Now, those people are entitled to the presumption of innocence until proven guilty, but there is an existing statutory framework under federal law where these people that resulted in these people being indicted for claims against them, and there will be a trial, and they will have the opportunity to present a defense, and the burden will be on the government to prove it. But in the face of this exemption that Representative Miller and the state chamber and at least 123 members of the General Assembly voted in favor of today, or I'm sorry, 117 members, 123 members yesterday on the constitutionality amendment. In their mind, with all of these terrible things that they spoke of, there is nothing, according to Representative Costa, that is changed or is made necessary because of this. And indeed, we also need to recognize that the law as it presently stands, at least until they pass this amendment in the Senate and send it off to Herr Corbett to sign, the current state of the law has this exemption for what is known as and defined as a labor dispute under the Pennsylvania anti-labor injunction law of 1937, and that applies equally to management. So I can assure you that if they pass this, when employers hire their thugs to bust up organizing drives and do things like call people at their homes to encourage them to vote against the union, that will now be criminal conduct as well.
Yeah, but here again, you've got to have the machinery who's going, the district attorneys who are going to file those, and you have to kind of wonder, But I look at this, and because I'm still trying to square this in my head. If all of the things that we've talked about, if all of the behavior that we all agree is wrong, if it's already illegal, and this does nothing, how is it that the people who tell me they want government out of my life, they want smaller, less intrusive government with less rules and less regulations, how does this square with the voter who would elect these people?
It doesn't. Simple answer is it doesn't. This is a case of legislative hyperbole seasoned with grandstanding and concluding in adopting a solution for a problem that does not exist. This is nuts. But on top of that, the professionals in the labor management relations field are both on the union side and the management side trying to get a job done. And this will create, inevitably, a sideshow where people of essentially bad intent use the criminal law as an excuse to not negotiate, to not bargain, to not meet their obligations, to say, in effect, that despite the fact that the law requires them to bargain in good faith, despite the fact that the law in Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act prohibits anybody, labor and management alike, from doing anything that interferes with or impedes the right of people to choose whether or not they want to be represented by a union under laboratory conditions without threat of reprisal, without intimidation, without fear. This upsets that entire apple cart. We will see situations inevitably now where working men and women and their employers don't get an opportunity to sit down at the bargaining table fairly under the laboratory conditions I just described, because this sideshow is going to be going on. Some district attorney in Mifflin County or in Carbon County or in Lycoming County or some other place who wants to get a name for herself or himself because he or she has to run for election and re-election or may want to run for election to a higher office will use this for their own piece of political grandstanding, and the people involved that are supposed to be involved at the bargaining table will evade or avoid the bargaining table because they will claim that they don't want to sit down across the table from somebody that's accused of criminal conduct.
Right.
So this creates a sideshow.
So we're just creating chaos is what you're saying.
It's creating chaos. And it's creating, by the way, yet one more unfunded mandate. Today, this morning, the House Appropriations Committee reviewed this bill for a fiscal note, which is required before the final passage of any piece of legislation. And that fiscal note attached to the bill says that while the committee cannot identify how much this is going to cost, they recognize with certainty that there will be a cost to local communities in the prosecution and investigation and possibly in the incarceration of people. So we have the state imposing yet another cost.
Man, we're threatening to lock working people up. I don't know how you square that whole less intrusive government, get government off my back with this stuff. So let me ask you the last question on this then, because it's my mindset that my right to organize, to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, it's a federally granted law. I mean, it's a federal law, and as I understand, you're the attorney here. Help me here. Doesn't that supersede what state law would do? Explain. And I guess the other part of this, does this hold up in court on any particular challenge?
Well, the answer goes like this. If I get overly technical, please disrupt me and ask questions. There is a long-standing concept in the area of federal and state relations known as federal preemption. And the concept, which has been approved over and over again by the federal judiciary, which has been recognized over and over again by the Congress of the United States, stands for the proposition that in an area where the government of the United States has acted, it is said to, I'm going to use a legal term of art here, occupy the field. That states, unless the federal law itself permits states to do more or do different, the federal law preempts any state law. So, inevitably, one of the other sad and painful costs is going to be, if they pass this, that a local district attorney is induced to file charges against someone, maybe a manager of a McDonald's or a Walmart who is merely carrying out the directives of her employer to take some action with respect to the employees of that McDonald's or that Walmart who may be trying to organize a union. And that person gets arrested, gets cuffed, gets carted away, gets mugshotted, gets her name or his name in the local newspaper, and then there is going to be two pieces of a war. Piece number one is going to be that person having to defend himself or herself in criminal court against criminal charges. The second piece is going to be somebody challenging the constitutionality of this new statute if it's adopted and signed into law by Corbett. Because of this notion of the federal government having occupied the field. And I wish I could give you and our listeners an answer tonight on that. I'm a lawyer. I know how to frame the issue. But the only cases on which I know the outcome are those where I get to make the decision. And unfortunately, we have 67 district attorneys in Pennsylvania. We have 67 judicial district courts of common pleas in Pennsylvania. That means there's going to be a dispute. There's going to be a difference. Somewhere there's going to be a DA who refuses to prosecute anybody because she recognizes the relationship between federal and state law. But someplace else there's going to be somebody that wants to make a name for himself, and that person is going to prosecute. And it may be in front of a judge that doesn't really care so much for federal law. And the judge is going to convict a person who is being victimized by a legislative action that is beyond the pale. And ultimately, we will be going to the Supreme Court.
And spending a lot more tax dollars that we could be spending on education and health care and roads and bridges that we could be using in a much, much better way than some political shenanigans because someone wants to look crazier than he probably is.
I don't know that it's looking crazier than he probably is, but it's looking pretty crazy. And by the way, while we're waiting for all of that to happen, while that legal process and that system of which I am a part works its will, somebody may well find that his or her freedom has been taken away from him or her, and they're living in a place behind bars in an orange jumpsuit.
And that will have a chilling effect also on organizing.
Exactly.
So there's an opportunity for our Republican friends to borrow the George Bush banner, mission accomplished. Maybe they get the sock for the drawers and everything else.
Could very well be. I just expect them to change and put on their military jackets and stand in front of the jailhouses of Pennsylvania and say, we fixed the problem. We can't identify what it is. Our colleagues who are in law enforcement say it's not a problem. But we fixed it anyway.
So we call our senators. We go that route. What do we do?
Well, right now, we don't know what committee the legislation is going to be committed to in the Senate. In the House, it was in the House Judiciary Committee, chaired by Dauphin County Republican Ron Marsico, and Representative Marsico was truly a belligerent in this when they had the public hearing on it. He assaulted Frank Snyder, who was merely trying to offer up the point of view of working men and women on this. So if it goes to the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is the place where it should go, but I can't guarantee that it will, that committee is chaired by Senator Stuart Greenleaf, who is from southeastern Pennsylvania, the Philadelphia suburbs. And Senator Greenleaf is a reasonable and rational man. I know him and have had the opportunity to work with him in the past. And we need to go to work. We need to start calling members of the state Senate and demanding that they either refuse to pass this legislation or that they amend it in a fashion that guarantees that our criminal statutes will not be used in a fashion that eliminates this protection that we've spoken of and that criminalizes federally protected conduct.
And again, in my view, it's call your senator immediately, get on the record early. And oh, by the way, go to therickSmithShow.com, click on Irwin's name, take you right to the video of Irwin, and you're very humble at it. You schooled the kid from the Chamber of Commerce, because you're right. And that's it, bottom line. Irwin, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good to be here. Talk to you next week.
All righty. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been discussing how America eventually adopted the color code of red.
The counselor advised an informal setting, adding that it is, quote, an effective way to build a better relationship. That sounds like advice that a love counselor might offer to couples, but not so. This relationship is about money. The counselor is a lobbyist for the healthcare industry, and he was explaining the art of wooing Congress critters by paying several thousand bucks to spend a weekend with them at some posh resort in Vail, Key West, or other luxury getaway. By holding what are called destination fundraisers outside of Washington, lawmakers and lobbyists can spend quality time together as they ski, snorkel, and schmooze. It's a way to get some large chunks of a lawmaker's time, oozed the lobbyist, who had recently enjoyed 3 days at the Four Seasons Resort in Vail with 5 Republican House members, 2 of whom are on the committee that writes our health laws. But wait, wasn't there a big stink over golf junkets a few years ago, forcing Congress to prohibit lobbyists from paying for these back-alley affairs? Yes, but Washington believes that where there's a will, there's a workaround. Here's how this one works. The lawmakers' political committees pay for their travel, food, booze, and lodging, so these expenses, technically, are not gifts from lobbyists. In turn, the favor seekers come at their own expense, plus making legal donations to the members' re-election campaigns. The donations end up being 3 or 4 times the cost of the event, so the lawmakers pocket a nice wad of cash, while the lobbyists enjoy a weekend of making legislative whoopee. Since the donations and the event are considered, quote, separate transactions, it's all legal. See? This is Jim Hightower saying, neither do I. In fact, what I see is just another corrupt way for corporations to buy Congress. Who do they think they're fooling?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And by the way, what we shouldn't do, I just got to say this, what we shouldn't be doing is trying to take away your rights to bargain for better wages or working conditions.
Thank you.
can tell this is an outdated song. You see, this is old because talking about the Employee Free Choice Act, wow. And I got to be honest, early on in the Obama term, I had hoped for this. I had hoped that there would be some changes to labor law to give workers the right, the absolute right to organize, that would be free from these type of attacks. And look, this is not just something that a couple of legislators here in Pennsylvania dreamt up. Look, don't give the Stephen Blooms and the Seth Groves and the Ron Millers and the Cutlers of the world, don't give them the credit for having a brain. This is not stuff that they dreamt up. They're not that bright. This is all stuff that was dropped into their lap. Here you go. We've done your work for you. And at the end of it, what it's all about is it's taking any power away from folks who are struggling right now. And they understand. Look, the wealth class of this country knows. We've been struggling. Workers have been struggling since 2001, really. Thanks to the Bush recession after Bush recession, wages have stagnated, actually declined. Inflation's going up. People are angry, and they're looking for something. Especially the younger generation who's going, what, there are no jobs? I'm saddled with massive student loan debt. I'm living in my parents' basement because I can't afford to get a place of my own because there's no job. They're going to be the ones who've said we've had enough. So what we're seeing right before our very eyes, we are seeing a systematic dismantling of the ability for them to make their lives better. Bottom line, that's it. And here in Pennsylvania, what they've done is they've taken this ALEC legislation, they've taken this billionaire legislation, they've taken this stuff that sounds actually pretty reasonable. Well, you shouldn't be allowed to use weapons of mass destruction, even though we know there are already laws on the books that already say that that's illegal. Well, you know, those union thugs are doing stuff, which also, if they're committing a crime, is also illegal. But freely exercising your right to picket, to strike, they're trying to wipe that away. So if you go back and you learn labor's history, nothing was handed to working people. Nothing was ever, there was no benevolence of, oh, we're going to give you all of these wonderful things. It was fought for and fought hard for. Understand, the wealth class of this country, they get it. They understand. They've read labor's history because they've been redefining it for the last 30 years. They understand what it took to build a middle class. They understand the mistakes that they made during the Roaring Twenties and into the Great Depression. They got it. They know where the mistakes are, and they know how to undo it. And when they cause the next Great Depression, in place will be all of the things that they want to make sure that they're insulated from you. That's what this is about. I look at a state like Mississippi. Mississippi has a very low unionization rate. I think I saw something like 3%. It's a right-to-work state already, so it's already anti-union from the get-go. What you've got right now is you've got a Senate there in Mississippi who says, well, that's not enough. It's not enough to be anti-worker anymore. It's not enough to be anti-union. It's not enough. What we've got to do is we've got to even take other things away. And they've got several pieces of legislation that, again, are going to be here soon. So the reason I'm telling you what's going on in Mississippi, so when it comes here to Pennsylvania, you don't go, well, our legislators sure smart. They sure wrote them bills up. Because they didn't. This stuff was handed to them at their ALEC conferences or put in their lazy little hands by some corporatist who says, you know what, this is what I want. Here's a campaign check. Anyway, in Mississippi, the three pieces of legislation, Senate Bill 2473, would make it illegal to try and entice companies to stay neutral. Like Volkswagen, for instance, stayed neutral. And there was some pressure from people saying, hey, we may boycott your product if you pursue an anti-union campaign. What they're going to do is they're almost going to make it illegal for employers to stay neutral and allow cards to be signed. And they're going to mandate these ballot elections, going to mandate it. Even if the employer says okay, they want to mandate it. Because they understand Nissan right now, there's a push towards organizing Nissan. And there's a push of people who are saying, you know, let the workers decide. You don't do like Volkswagen did. Don't hire union busters. Don't hire thugs to come in and harass and intimidate. Let the workers decide. Let them decide. It's that simple. Well, Mississippi law would make that illegal. Senate Bill 2653 in the right to work state with like 3% union density. Would make picketing and protesting illegal. You know, if you block the entranceway, if you walk in front of the door, that's illegal. Violation could be 6 months in jail. Senate Bill 2797 would then ban, here it is, would ban project labor agreements. Now, these are the people who tell us we want smaller, less intrusive government. We want government out of your lives. We want private interests to be able to come freely to decisions in the free open market, but we're going to ban your ability in a right-to-work state already. Going to make it illegal to sign a project labor agreement. Now, understand what a project labor agreement does. And it's only as good as it is written. But a project labor agreement sets the standards for everybody to follow. So you don't have cutthroat competition, and you don't have one guy who's screwing things up. Everybody plays by the same rules. Makes managing it a whole lot easier. And if you wanted to look at it from a construction worker standpoint or a construction company standpoint, you would have to go, well, if it's easier to manage, that might mean it might be more cost effective, and this way a better value, more profit, better for the workers, better for the taxpayers. But no. We want to make that illegal because, well, it's something that labor wants. Because it's good for the workers, it's good for the taxpayers, it's good for the projects. This stuff is coming to Pennsylvania. Understand that. All of this insanity is coming here, and I've been saying this for years, and I hate being right. I've been calling this for years, saying this stuff is coming, wake up, prepare, be ready, be organized, and yet here we are. So now that it's here, now you've really got to put the pedal to the metal. You've really got to call your senators right now. First thing in the morning, get on the horn with the senator and say, hey, look, this is ridiculous. Completely, totally outrageous. And you've got to vote against it. That simple. Quick break. Right back with hour two. Red roses too. I see them blue.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. North America's building trades unions are urging immediate approval of the Keystone XL pipeline project. They say environmental and national security impacts have been adequately debated and addressed, and it's time to approve the pipeline and the estimated 42,100 jobs throughout the U.S. the unions say that it would create. Laborers Union President Terry O'Sullivan.
To the tens of thousands of men and women in the construction industry, this isn't just a pipeline. It's their mortgages, college tuitions, car payments, and food on a table. And for our country, this isn't just a pipeline. It's a lifeline to family security, energy security, and national security. The American people want to build the pipeline. Just last week, an ABC Washington Post poll showed 65% of Americans support it, and 85% believe Keystone will create a significant number of jobs. It's time to wring the politics out of Keystone XL pipeline and to make a decision based on the will of the people and based on the national interest of our great country.
The Sierra Club, the Natural Resources Defense Council, National Nurses United, and some Canadian unions are among those opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline. They say, according to the U.S. State Department, the pipeline would create 6,500 temporary construction jobs at most, and they say, according to TransCanada, the company building the pipeline, only hundreds of permanent jobs will be left when the pipeline is finished. A Cornell University study also says the pipeline would allegedly kill more jobs than it would create by cutting investment in the clean energy economy. National Nurses United says that pipeline would accelerate unhealthy climate change. Progress Missouri recently delivered nearly 7,000 handwritten letters opposing anti-union legislation known as Right to Work to Missouri House Speaker Tim Jones. Progress Missouri Executive Director Sean Nicholson explains why the group opposes what it calls the Right to Work for Less legislation it says will harm working families.
We are fighting back on the so-called right to work bills and on paycheck deception and other kinds of attacks because we know that this is about the entire middle class in Missouri and the kind of state that we want for our families and for the future. We know that states with so-called right to work laws have lower wages, have lower rates of insurance, have lower investments in education. And that's not the kind of state that we want for Missouri.
Nearly 3 years ago, Connecticut was the first state to legally guarantee paid sick days for workers. A new report on the paid sick day law from the Center on Economic and Policy Research shows it had little or no negative impact on businesses in the state. Senior economist and report co-author Dr. Eileen Applebaum says the sick days law hasn't imposed major burdens on businesses. She says rather than the job killer opponents said it would be, over three-quarters of employers reported a positive experience with the law.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
As to what to do for the housing industry specifically, and are there things that you can do to encourage housing, one is don't try and stop the foreclosure process. Let it run its course and hit the bottom, allow investors to buy homes, put renters in them, fix the homes up, and let it turn around and come back up. The Obama administration has slow-walked the foreclosure processes that have long existed, and as a result, we still have a foreclosure overhang.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, I listened to that comment by Romney, and look, yeah, that was the goal of a lot of Republicans. That was the goal of a lot of policymakers who said, you know what, those people who are in trouble, the heck with them. Let them lose the home. We'll sell them off and put them back in there as renter. Good business decision, good profitable decision. So I saw last week this story, and we talked about it at length last week in the Central Pennsylvania Business Journal, that according to Realty Track Incorporated, in January they saw all cash sales for real estate here in the U.S., 44.4% of all transactions, of all sales, were cash sales. Here in Pennsylvania, almost 41% of the homes being purchased were cash sales. And it got me thinking, who are these people who have all this money? Because I don't know anyone who's reached into their pocket and found some lint at the bottom. When I reach in, I find lint, but I don't know who finds enough money to buy a house. So here to help answer some of those questions, I've asked Mark Bidding. He's a mortgage specialist to come talk with us. Mark, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure.
So I see these numbers. I mean, and to me, this is just eye-popping. 44.4% of the homes in January that were purchased, of residential homes, purchased with all cash. How's that? Do you see that in your world?
I honestly don't. But I think what we're hearing, and I know I've talked to some of my friends with the Mortgage Bankers Association, they're finding a lot of folks that are purchasing these properties as investment properties. So a lot of it's coming in. You're seeing banks that are still, trying to get rid of foreclosed properties. I know that those numbers have decreased over the past couple of years, but you're still seeing that. And I think the fact that interest rates have risen a little bit, I think, although they are still historically low, a lot of investors looking at this and saying now might be the time to take on some of these, if I have money available and I can buy up some of these properties, and I think that's what we're seeing.
So basically we're seeing what Romney proposed, this idea of, as the foreclosure, this is your view on it, we're seeing the foreclosures out there, the people who are close to being foreclosed They're selling dirt cheap, and there are people, investors, who are saying we're going to gobble this stuff up.
Well, I think they're just taking an opportunity when they do see these properties out there, and some of them are you know, selling maybe lower than market value as well in some of these markets. Not necessarily here in central Pennsylvania, because I don't think we see quite as much of that, but maybe some of that in the Harrisburg market, mostly in the more urban areas you're going to see that. And we see a lot more properties, you know, for sale in those markets as well.
Yeah, I mean, because I was looking at the numbers, and, you know, they were saying the institutional investors made up about 2% of the sales here in Pennsylvania, of the auctions of foreclosure, about 0.6%. So you're going, you know, who's selling these properties and who's buying them is one of those questions, because one of my big fears is you end up seeing the a mass grab by, you know, who knows what. Maybe we're bundling these things again and selling them off like bad investments as we have in the past. And are we creating another bubble? Are we creating another bad situation? I'm curious your thought.
Well, I don't necessarily believe that we're going to see a bubble or anything like that, but I think we are seeing properties that were, you know, financed maybe with some of these products that were low down payment monies, or, you know, limited down payment, no income, no asset products that some lenders offered, you know, back in the, you know, early to mid 2000s. And then what you're seeing is that those folks that, you know, probably shouldn't have had those properties, or, you know, most likely couldn't have afforded them, they're the ones that are now forced to give those properties up. And then there's their big purpose. That would be my thoughts on that.
Are we still seeing some of the bad practices and some of the gimmicky practices that we saw, you know, maybe just 10 years ago?
No, they're pretty much, you really don't. I'm not saying that there might not be somebody out there, but there are, with the new regulations and the guidelines being really tightened up, you really don't see as much of that, quite honestly. I mean, I don't know of anybody that's doing stated income, stated asset loans right now or things like that. Now, there are products out there that, you know, people can still take advantage of that are low down payment, such as a government-sponsored program like, you know, VA, which is 100% financing. But they do have, you know, particular requirements, though, you know, as far as, you know, decent credit and requirements on the property itself. That the veteran might be purchasing. And then also, like, USDA, which is a government-sponsored product as well, can go up to 100% financing.
Is that a good idea, though? I mean, I remember talking to a friend of mine who had been he's been retired from the banking industry for probably longer than most of us have been working. But he says he seemed to remember when the banking industry kind of made this big, wide swing away from your ability, one's ability to pay and their ability to afford the property that they're buying, to this idea of, well, what's the asset worth? What's the house going to be worth when we foreclose on it? And how much money are we going to get back out of it so that we can churn them? And he said it was a fundamental shift in banking away from the mentality of putting X amount of dollars down, having savings, having income sufficient to continue payments. Have we seen a shift back to that, or do you still see it based on some of the bad things that we've moved in towards?
I would have to say it has definitely swung back to a more conservative lending pattern that we saw, you know, probably 15 years ago, where you had, you know, debt to income ratios that were a lot tighter, where we had like a 28% housing ratio and maybe a 36%, you know, total debt to income ratio. We used to use those quite a bit, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And then with the automation, and you got with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they developed these automated underwriting systems, which, you know, it took information on a particular borrower and it would score it, and it would what they call layered risk. It would look at information like their job time and the amount of credit maybe that they have and their credit card limits versus what they have, you know, borrowed against those cards. And it would kind of layer those things and take all that into consideration, and if there's any, like, delinquency, and it would score those things. And it would give you, like, an accept rating, which would allow you to lend. Well, with those things, it allowed – it may not look necessarily at those ratios, so it was less concerned with that if it had other factors to consider. And it seems now that a lot of the investors out there are kind of going back to the old school, even though Fannie and Freddie, with their automated systems, might be allowing something to go through. A lot of lenders now are becoming more conservative and are tightening up their debt-to-income ratios and qualification ratios, mainly because of, you know, new regulations that, you know, that have just gone into place here in January,
right?
Which, you know, would be the qualified mortgage rule. So there's specific guidelines now that lenders have to follow, and it's tightened up, you know, significantly from where it was even 2 years ago.
So as someone who lives in this world, the mortgage world, the regulations, do you believe onerous? Do you believe good, bad? Thoughts?
I think, you know, it's like anything else. It seems like, you know, once there's some bad things, and there's always a few that seem to cause problems for the majority, and it's a few people that cause those problems in any kind of industry. And ours in particular would be, you know, lending to folks maybe that couldn't necessarily afford those things, but the guidelines allowed for it.
Yeah, but Mark, I mean, we had a massive collapse. That I don't know that many people could have foreseen, with losing hundreds of thousands of jobs per month, and with those jobs, people losing their homes. I don't know that anybody could have foresaw what was coming, in that vein, and the number of people who just lost their homes, pretty much because they lost their jobs, and we had a massive jobs crisis.
Right, and that's a great point as well, because now you also have, you know, although we're hearing that there is a, you know, that the economy seems to be picking up a little bit, there still aren't the type of jobs that people had a couple years ago.
Right.
Your point is taken. That you're right. That, and I think that that's one of the reasons we're not probably seeing as many people that are actually buying these homes for, you know, their residents in some of these markets, and you're seeing investors picking them up.
So now, is it possible? Because one of those, when I had talked about this last week, I had gotten a bunch of emails from people. That, you know, is this the Chinese money that we're sending overseas in the way of our trade deficits? Because we have about $500 billion trade deficit last year, and we've run trade deficits with China every year for the last, since 1992, and we've run trade deficits basically every year of NAFTA. So we've had massive trade deficits. The worry there was, you know, some people are going, wow, this could be the result of our insane trade coming back to bite us in the behind as well.
I can't speak for. I'm not qualified to comment on, quite honestly.
So who are these folks? Any sense of where is this Wall Street doing this? Or is this the guy down the street going, hey, I'd like to become a slumlord or buy a couple of properties? What's your sense?
I think it's the guy down the street that's starting to pick up, you know, that thinks that they can, you know, invest in real estate. They think right now property values are lower, interest rates are pretty decent, and I think, you know, some people have some extra cash. They're concerned about the stock market. They think that, you know, they're diversifying and they're putting some of it in the real estate market. And I think that, you know, that's the mentality out there. So those folks that are getting involved, and, you know, there's a lot of like these shows out there that, you know, these, you know, flip it, you know,
yeah,
you know, programs and things. And I think, you know, that drives some of this as well.
They make it look so easy. Anyone could do it, even you.
Right. Exactly.
And my fear is we create another one of these situations where you get a bunch of these people who are buying this stuff up, and now we got another crisis on our hands.
But I think also, but you're going to find that it's becoming more difficult to own numerous properties. I mean, there are a lot of guidelines because you know, to do like a Fannie or a Freddie Mac type of loan, what we, you know, like a secondary market loan, you can't, you know, most lenders aren't going to allow you to finance more than four properties. So you could have 10 properties, but if you can't finance more than four of them, it becomes an issue that the lender's not going to lend because of those guidelines that Fannie and Freddie have. Now, that's not to say that there wouldn't be private investors or private lenders out there that may get involved in some of these things. But for the most part, I think used to be you could finance up to 10 properties, and they cut that back to four now. So
okay,
some of those things will kind of curb some of that.
Good. I don't mind if private investors lose their money. I just don't want tax dollars bailing banks out again for more bad decisions. And I'm feeling a little bit better. I haven't talked to you.
Okay. Well, thank you.
I'm glad I got a sense of what these numbers are. So that's not as horrible as I thought.
Okay.
So it was great talking with you, Mark. I appreciate your time.
You too. You're welcome, Rick.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m. I must tell you that.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Craig Harrington. Top Senate Democrats and members of the Senate Climate Action Task Force held the floor Monday for an all-night talkathon to push congressional action on climate change. America's Newsroom co-host Martha McCallum suggested that there are more important issues than climate change.
You know, you look at some of the major issues that we're dealing with right now, and I know that you feel strongly about global warming and that you feel it's an important issue. The only reason, I'm going at it is because I don't understand why they're not actually having the guts to put out legislation there and to vote on it and to see what happens from it.
Since Republicans gained control of the House majority in 2010, most climate legislation has been dead on arrival. Despite Fox's dismissal of the urgency of addressing climate change, The Guardian reported that studies show climate change is already damaging the global economy. And economist Dean Baker, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, explained that climate change will have much greater costs to the future than government debt. For more on climate change and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
The counselor advised an informal setting, adding that it is, quote, an effective way to build a better relationship. That sounds like advice that a love counselor might offer to couples, but not so. This relationship is about money. The counselor is a lobbyist for the healthcare industry, and he was explaining the art of wooing Congress critters by paying several thousand bucks to spend a weekend with them at some posh resort in Vail, Key West, or other luxury getaway. By holding what are called destination fundraisers outside of Washington, lawmakers and lobbyists can spend quality time together as they ski, snorkel, and schmooze. It's a way to get some large chunks of a lawmaker's time, oozed the lobbyist, who had recently enjoyed 3 days at the Four Seasons Resort in Vail with 5 Republican House members, 2 of whom are on the committee that writes our health laws. But wait, wasn't there a big stink over golf junkets a few years ago, forcing Congress to prohibit lobbyists from paying for these back-alley affairs? Yes, but Washington believes that where there's a will, there's a workaround. Here's how this one works. The lawmakers' political committees pay for their travel, food, booze, and lodging, so these expenses, technically, are not gifts from lobbyists. In turn, the favor seekers come at their own expense, plus making legal donations to the members' re-election campaigns. The donations end up being 3 or 4 times the cost of the event, so the lawmakers pocket a nice wad of cash, while the lobbyists enjoy a weekend of making legislative whoopee. Since the donations and the event are considered, quote, separate transactions, it's all legal. See? This is Jim Hightower saying, neither do I. In fact, what I see is just another corrupt way for corporations to buy Congress. Who do they think they're fooling?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So conservatives going nuts today. The Republicans are going crazy. The corporatists losing their mind because... Well, Obama said he was going to use the pen, didn't he? Going to use the pen and the phone. Going to start making phone calls. Going to start doing some executive orders. Well, one of the first things he has decided that he's going to take a look at is this exemption that they give to managerial types. I've often said that just for that title, people, especially in the fast food industry, especially and big box retailers, especially the retail industry, because they and I remember my ex-wife, she was the manager of a small shoe store in one of the mall, one of the malls when we were in college. And, you know, one of her first jobs out of college was this shoe store manager. And I remember she was working weeks, 50, 60 hours, 70 hours. When someone didn't show up, she'd have to go in and cover the shift and never got anything for it. But she was salaried. She was exempt. And I remember going, that's insane to me. It's insane to me. But, you know, my management is the throw out there. And I don't know that there's ever really been a bottom of, you know, how many hours you can work, how much you can make during that time, what the, you know, how this all works, because, you know, I never really gave two shakes about management, to be honest with you. You're dumb enough to get yourself jammed up. I got other problems. And what you find out in the stories that I've read here in the last couple hours, you got these guys, these people who are these men and women who are making, in some cases, less than minimum wage because they're exempt from overtime. Now, what the president is proposing is that he's going to use his executive, the pen, going to use an executive order to update our labor law a little bit and say who is and who is not exempt from the minimum from the time and a half. Portion of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Under the current rules, if you're labeled exempt, you could be executive, administrative, professional, you're denied overtime because you have a white collar exemption. So, you know, that means, you know, if there's someone who oversees the, you know, whatever's going on, they're the boss, they're classified executive and they don't have to be paid time and a half. Now what Obama's proposing would be to readjust that so that, you know, where the salary employees can at least have some minimum. And what I'm hearing the number is, and I guess I'm not hearing the number. Right now I guess the threshold is $455 a week, which I guess is somewhere around, you know, $23,000 a year. Now, not too long ago, the Economic Policy Institute, they took a look at that and said, hey, you know, if we raise that threshold up to $970 or a little over $50,000 a year, you'd have about 10 million workers in this country who would get some form of overtime pay. Maybe not just overtime pay, but maybe you would end up getting some people who are going to get jobs. Because what ends up happening is you see employers going, well, we know that we've got this salaried sucker who, you know, we said you're going to work, you know, 40 hours some weeks, 50 hours some weeks, 60 hours, but you're still going to make that same paltry wage, and they don't have to hire anybody. I think it's a smart move. Now, it's going to have to stay, it's going to be subject to public comment before it's finally, moved on in the Labor Department, but I think it's a step in the right direction. It's something, I got to be honest, should have been done years ago. Because I've often said that management, especially the lower level management, especially in industries like fast food or restaurants or retail, you know, your mall supervisors or however you want to put that, they're the ones who end up getting the short end of the stick. Now understand, wages have been falling for the last several years. Since 2007, wages have declined 7%. Going backwards. And I just talk about myself. In my lifetime, you know, I think back to the jobs that I had as a young man, looking at you know, a kid right now, 20 years old, getting out of high school or getting out of college. I mean, 18 out of high school, 20, 22, getting out of college, going, you know, okay, I can't find a job in my field. I'm going to go do a manual labor job. And I worked on the freight docks, you know, loading trucks by hand and throwing boxes and doing all that. And I made a decent amount of money. I made $15 an hour with some health care and a little pension money I'll put aside, thanks to my union. And I made a good living. After 8 hours, I got overtime. After 40, you got overtime, obviously. today doing that exact same job. I was told $12 an hour. You're talking about not adjusted for inflation, not fiddled around, not screwing the numbers over, but actual dollar for dollar. Take me back to 1987, 1988. I was making $15 an hour. Here we are, 2014. Some 27 years later, the wages have gone backwards. And the benefits aren't there either. So that's a pay cut. So when I see this piece of legislation like House Bill 1154 that just passed today in the Pennsylvania General Assembly, I start going, uh-huh, see, they're setting the stage. They know what's coming. They're setting the stage so that, you know what? Sorry, you don't have an avenue to fight for those better wages, hours, conditions. You don't have the ability to fight for a future because they're taking it away. And for those people who go, well, I'll never be a union, I'll never need any of that, you absolutely do. And I find it incredibly disheartening that there are people who don't realize how interconnected all of us really are. We've been preached to, we've been promulgated to, we've been propagated to, all of, that we're the individual, and hooray for me, and the heck with everyone else, I did it, just me. And that there's this benevolent company who has bestowed these wonderful gifts upon me. I think we should take our heads out of the dark side of the moon. You know, a little popping sound as your head pops out, and realize that as they're taking this stuff away, as they're spending tons of money, they're doing it for a reason. And that reason is power, control, and the ability to, no matter what, make sure that you don't take what's theirs. And right now we're here in the right wing with a lot of dog whistle politic, especially when anyone talks about income inequality. Because the message that's come from the right is, anytime those workers talk about income inequality, they're talking about redistribution of wealth. And I'm one of the first to raise my hand and say, yes, yes I am. I want it redistributed back to the way it was when I was working, throwing boxes on a dock, making $15 an hour, and working people had a shot at making a decent middle class living. Yes, I would like to go back to that. I would like to return to the ability to do that. And I don't know very many people who would argue with me. Especially if you're one of the folks that I know who, week after week, month after month, you get to the end of it and you go, I just don't have enough to make it. And then you got people like Paul Ryan who says, if you have to ask for the school lunch program to help feed your kids, somehow you don't love your children. Think about that. Think about the world that our kids are inheriting because of the bad decisions we're allowing to happen right before our very eyes. Sad stuff. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
North America's building trades unions are urging immediate approval of the Keystone XL pipeline project. They say environmental and national security impacts have been adequately debated and addressed, and it's time to approve the pipeline and the estimated 42,100 jobs throughout the U.S. the unions say that it would create. Laborers Union President Terry O'Sullivan.
To the tens of thousands of men and women in the construction industry, this isn't just a pipeline. It's their mortgages, college tuitions, car payments, and food on the table. And for our country, this isn't just a pipeline. It's a lifeline to family security, energy security, and national security. The American people want to build the pipeline. Just last week, an ABC Washington Post poll showed 65% of Americans support it, and 85% believe Keystone will create a significant number of jobs. It's time to wring the politics out of Keystone XL pipeline and to make a decision based on the will of the people and based on the national interest of our great country.
The Sierra Club, the Natural Resources Defense Council, National Nurses United, and some Canadian unions are among those opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline. They say, according to the U.S. State Department, the pipeline would create 6,500 temporary construction jobs at most, and they say, according to TransCanada, the company building the pipeline, only hundreds of permanent jobs will be left when the pipeline is finished. A Cornell University study also says the pipeline would allegedly kill more jobs than it would create by cutting investment in the clean energy economy. National Nurses United says that pipeline would accelerate unhealthy climate change. Progress Missouri recently delivered nearly 7,000 handwritten letters opposing anti-union legislation known as Right to Work to Missouri House Speaker Tim Jones. Progress Missouri Executive Director Sean Nicholson explains who opposes what it calls the Right to Work for Less legislation it says will harm working families.
We are fighting back on the so-called right to work bills and on paycheck deception and other kinds of attacks because we know that this is about the entire middle class of Missouri and the kind of state that we want for our families and for the future. We know that states with so-called right to work laws have lower wages, have lower rates of insurance, have lower investments in education. And that's not the kind of state that we want for Missouri.
Nearly 3 years ago, Connecticut was the first state to legally guarantee paid workers. A new report on the paid sick day law from the Center on Economic and Policy Research shows it had little or no negative impact on businesses in the state. Senior economist and report co-author Dr. Eileen Applebaum says the sick days law hasn't imposed major burdens on businesses. She says rather than the job killer opponents said it would be, over three-quarters of employers reported a positive experience with the law.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, the last couple of days, I've just been fixated on Paul Ryan. These idiotic comments just keep coming. It's amazing, you know, what's that saying? When you find yourself in a ditch, stop digging. That he just keeps digging and digging and digging. This idea that if a family's too poor, they don't have the resources to put something in a brown paper bag for their children to take for lunch. Somehow they don't love their children. That wasn't enough. He then went on, he was on the Bill Benich, which again is one of those, you know, right-wing hack programs that I choose not to listen to, but a listener sent me this clip that I absolutely had to play. Bennett asks the question.
Okay. But, I mean, a boy has to see a man working, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And so that's this tailspin or spiral that we're looking at in our communities. You know, your buddy Charles Murray or Bob Putnam over at Harvard, those guys have written books on this, which is we have got this tailspin of culture in our inner cities in particular of men not working and just generations of men not even thinking about working or learning the value and the culture of work. And so there's a real culture problem here that has to be dealt with. Everybody's...
No, it has to be dealt with. Not that there's no jobs available, but that they're lazy and they're stupid, like our governor says. Can't pass a drug test. So here to help me work through some of these problems, this idea especially that poor folks like my mother... Me growing up in a housing project as a kid, my mother, who we didn't have food at the end of the month in the cupboards, when I had to ask for help at school and get school lunch, somehow, according to Paul Ryan, she didn't love me. She just didn't love me enough. I've asked Stacey Perlman. She's assistant professor of human development and family studies at the University of Delaware. She's also a visiting scholar at the People's Emergency Center in West Philadelphia. Stacy, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
So I hear Paul Ryan say this, which I think is vile. I think it's disgusting. I think if he'd have said it in front of me, I'd have broke his nose. But that's just me. I'm curious your thoughts on the brown bag, the made-up comment on the brown bag.
I guess I had a sort of threefold response to it. So first is an academic response. I'm a researcher. I focus primarily on development and well-being of young children and youth who are experiencing homelessness and or who are involved in the child welfare system. And a lot of my work ends up focusing on building strong parent-child relationships. And from a very pure academic perspective, when I think about, you know, how do we understand what constitutes a positive parent-child relationship, it falls well beyond the idea of a brown bag lunch, and much more into the interactions that occur between the parent and child. Again, beyond a brown paper bag lunch, what is the daily interaction? Does the child feel supported? Is the parent responding to the child? And those are ways of understanding constitutes a caring, loving parent-child relationship.
And I perfectly understand that. You know, as a kid who, as I said, you know, I never once did I ever question whether my mother had an affection for me whatsoever. But I do remember numerous times going to the cupboards and there being nothing there. I do remember having to go when I was in school and go to the special line or get my name checked off of a certain list. I remember being angry at the lunch lady who made a production out of it. I remember being angry at that, but I never once did I ever question the affection of my mother in that vein.
Through the work I do, I have the opportunity to spend time talking with moms who are living in emergency or transitional housing, very specifically about their relationships with their children. And I think what has been most consistent has been a very deep expression of love for their children and wanting their children to do well and understanding the importance of supporting their children, the importance of school, and wanting to do as much as they can. And that really stands out. And, you know, I've been thinking about this whole brown bag lunch thing, and I have to say, as an academic, I've never read a study specifically citing the importance of brown bag lunches. But from an academic perspective, if one really wanted to push that issue, it would surface the question of why not ensure that every family then has the ability to provide a brown bag lunch.
Agreed.
Make sure that every family has a brown bag, has food to put in the bag, and then talk about how that connects to parent-child relationship.
Because at the end of this, my problem is it's always been, it's a jobs crisis. So it's one thing to go out there and point your finger and say, mom doesn't love her kids because they can't put something in a bag. And it's another thing to say that, you know, those lazy inner city people, they won't take care of their families because they're too lazy to work when they realize there's no work to be had. I mean, I grew up in an area where we weren't on the bus route. They didn't have lots of jobs in the neighborhood, so there was a high unemployment rate. We have a jobs crisis, and I don't see the people like Paul Ryan and the rest of them who in 2010 told me they were going to focus, laser-like focus, on jobs, jobs, jobs. All I see is this kind of divisiveness, this kind of vitriol, this kind of bogus ideology, and it's infuriating.
And I think in connection to the jobs issue is just the complexities facing families. So I spend time out in the community talking with families about their experiences. And for moms of young children, part of having stable employment is having access to childcare.
Right.
And we want childcare to be high-quality childcare because we You know, we want kids to be having the best experiences that they possibly can. But how do we ensure that families can get access to that child care? And how do we ensure that that child care is available in every neighborhood so that families don't have to take 3 or 4 or 5 buses or try to figure out how to incorporate a stop that's completely far away from their jobs? And in order to, for the mom to get a job, she has to have child care. So it ends up making it's just very, very complex.
See, you've already laid out the problems, some of the problems, and how complex they are and how difficult they are to sell. It is so much easier just to point the finger and say lazy, just to point the finger and say you don't love your kids, just to point the finger and make these accusations, because that's so much easier than actually rolling up your sleeves and digging into what the actual problems are and solving them. And I would argue education being one of the biggest ones. And we've got a governor here in Pennsylvania who has gutted $2 billion from public education. How is that going to make things better for poor families?
It's certainly not going to make things any less challenging. And I think in terms of, you know, the finger pointing, I would say, I think the most valuable thing that could happen would be to simply talk with families, because it becomes a lot more challenging to see things as an individual trouble once you have the opportunity to speak with them. I mean, just hearing the hopes and the dreams that the moms have, that they want to go to college, they want to, I've talked with a mom who wanted to go to school, wanted to eventually get her master's degree, and be able to start support for other families who are experiencing similar things that she has so that she could give back. You know, and it's hard to argue that her current circumstance is her doing when you can hear her talk about that and her passion and her willingness and her drive. You know, it becomes necessary to look at what's happening systemically and more broadly in terms of her being able to achieve those dreams.
Right. But, you know, what you would then get, and look, it's always easier to, and you do the hard work of going out into communities and talking with people as a visiting scholar at the People's Emergency Center there in West Philadelphia. I'm sure that you collect tons of these stories, and that's the hard work. It's a lot easier to come up with an anecdotal story to say, oh, well, you know, there's this kid, or there's the welfare queen driving around in the Cadillac collecting welfare on 50 kids, and that's their tax dollars. It's a lot easier to do that than it is to actually collect these stories and figure out how to help these individuals and society as a whole.
I mean, I think if you start off talking about some of the costs, I think if you wanted to go that route, we did some work last year where we were looking at the actual costs associated with childhood homelessness, and found that on average, above and beyond the cost of providing services to house kids, trying to address a lot of the complexity that happens when a family does experience homelessness, per child is approximately $33,000 a year.
How's that?
Well, if you account for the reality that kids who are experiencing homelessness are less likely to have access to a primary care doctor, and so there's a cost associated with using the emergency room instead of a primary care doctor.
Yep.
They're more likely to be diagnosed with chronic ear infections, with anemia, with asthma, all, again, medical conditions that if they were managed, would still cost something, but not nearly as much as if there's a crisis and they need to be managed through sort of more crisis medical care. In terms of homelessness, trauma is a big factor, so mental health comes into play. And with that, increased likelihood of contact with the child welfare system, which has a cost associated with it. If we don't respond early, there's an increased likelihood that the child may end up needing special education, which has a cost. And if we really don't respond early, an increased likelihood that the child may not graduate from high school, which has a substantial long-term cost. And so when you take all of that together, in some ways, the cost of not being preventive, of not addressing needs early on, comes at a much higher cost in the long term.
Yeah, and if you don't catch it early, then even worse down the road, the for-profit prison industry's cheering, hooray, 96% of our beds are now full because, these kids didn't get a good education. So then explain to me how it is we've got political leaders like Paul Ryan and his ideological ilk who don't see what you're saying and really invest in trying to stop this before it gets to the end of the road where we know it's going. We know it's going to high dropout rates. We know it's going to high teenage pregnancy rates. We know it's going to high prison rates. Why aren't we being more proactive?
That's a great question.
It's a common sense question. You've laid out it is extremely costly. What you $33,000 a year? We could send a kid to one of the best colleges in the country for that kind of money. If that's what we're spending, and maybe it is, we just don't know it. But if we're spending that kind of money, why is it we're saddling these people and we're sentencing these kids to a future of poverty and desperation when we're investing tens of thousands of dollars in them?
I mean, I think part of it may be, as you're saying, that the costs are ultimately distributed across time. So it's not, on a child-to-child basis. That $33,000, although it averages out as a per child, that's going to be accrued across 18 or more years.
Right.
And a lot of what we know works in terms of really supporting, in particular, vulnerable children is in early childhood, and they're young, they're not visible.
They don't have lobbyists.
If they may not have lobbyists. We don't see them generally, and if they're not seen, it's very easy to ignore what their needs are. I think it's also thinking of it as an investment. I mean, we need to put money in while they're young, with the idea being that when they're older, that's when you see the benefits of that investment. It's not an immediate return.
Right.
It's ensuring that young children and their families have what they need in order to get started on the right foot and be able to continue. So it's you have to look ahead. You can't just look forward. Now.
Right. I'm right there with you. And I wish our policymakers would think in that way. But the sad reality is that they look election cycle to election cycle. We don't have visionary statesmen, as I would argue at some point in our past we may have had, especially when you start talking about programs like the school lunch program, which in my view, if I remember reading about it, at least the milk programs that came into school, it's because the military needed people to go off to war because kids were emaciated, and that was a way to get them nutrition. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Stacey Perlman, Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the University of Delaware. She's also a visiting scholar at the People's Emergency Center in West Philadelphia. To find out more information about those places, go to thericksmithshow.com. You can click on Stacey's name, take you right to we've got links to all of that. Let me ask you last line of questioning, because you said you had three levels of thought on Paul Ryan's statement. You gave the academic portion of your thought. I'm curious what the other two were.
So the second would be actually talking with the moms. So hearing from them what their experiences are, it would be hard to make the argument that they don't care about or love their children once you talk to them. I mean, it just the depth of the love that they have for their children is very salient and motivates a lot of what they're doing. And, I think the other thing, just in talking with them, so I've been talking with them in the context of looking at parenting support. And one of the things that they report that they love the most is that these supports give them the opportunity to spend more time with their children. So it just, I mean, on that level, just hearing them talk, it would be very hard to buy into the argument that a brown bag lunch is equated with parental love. And then, as I said before, in a somewhat, and I don't necessarily advocate doing this, but if one truly, truly believed that somehow a brown bag lunch was associated with better parenting, then to me the response would be, why not ensure that all parents have the capacity to provide that? And then talk about how it connects to parenting or not. But I think to just draw that connection in some ways flies in the face of what we know from many years of studying parent-child relationships, right, really constitutes a positive parent-child relationship.
But for me, I guess, I'm sure he did not mean it to be the firestorm that came of it. It's just another one of those things that they make up that fit their ideology, and it sounds like such a nice story, and it would play to the minions among them, and that's as far as it would go. And if it offended a few, so be it. But I got to tell you, very, very few things offend me. That was one of those things where I think I would have gone ghetto all over him, which is how I grew up. But that's a whole different ball of wax. Stacey, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us, and thanks for your insight.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show for working people from the talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show. So now you see the light.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I look at this and understand. I'm sure Paul Ryan thought this was a slam dunk winner. It was going to be one of those talking points that just you know, glossed over, and people would be going, oh, yeah, see, there's a child, and the child's right. And that would become the welfare queen or the small family farmer who lost their farm because of that dreaded, evil, nasty, onerous death tax. Yeah. Yeah, and they never found either one of them. Just like this kid, they didn't find the kid either, because it doesn't exist. But it makes for a nice meme, does it? Nice frame. And it plays to that. I want to pull myself up by my bootstraps. Does a really nice job of that. And I got to be honest, I hope others are as enraged about those comments as I am, and especially the most recent ones. You know, I played that little clip with Ryan talking to Bennett on his program. I don't often play other people's programs, but, you know, this statement that, well, you know, the problem with the inner city is that the men have left. Problem with the inner city is no jobs. Problem is we've done a horrible job of giving people opportunity. Horrible. That's our crisis. And if we, and I've been saying this for a while, if we went and said, you know what, government will be the employer of last resort. We're going to make sure people have jobs. I think things turn around. Anyway, we got an email during the break. Randall asks the question. He says, I was a white collar. I was white collar in the 90s, but not management, and never got overtime. Did I get ripped off? Depends on your status. You know, like I said, you know, they designate administrative, executive. White collar is not, management. It wasn't the only designation. Executive, those things exempt, and it's right on your tax form. They make you an exempt employee, because you're then basically exempt from all of those laws, the Fair Labor Standards Act, which puts you directly on the exploitation table. And it's about time. I give Obama credit. He's going to take a lot of heat from the Republicans, but it's about time he grew a spine and actually did something that I think is going to make people's lives a little bit better. At least 10 million people, if they were to raise it up even higher. And I think they're talking, and I'm not quite sure where this is going to go. We'll find out more tomorrow. But the fact that he's willing to step forward and say, we're going to do this, to me, is a step in the right direction, a sign in the right direction. There are a lot of things I'm still ticked off at him about, but a step, I think, in the right direction. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where we've got the podcast. We've got the little player there. You just go to the website, listen anytime you want. You can get the Stitcher app, also iTunes, all of that right there for your convenience, your entertainment, all of that. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. North America's building trades unions are urging immediate approval of the Keystone XL pipeline project. They say environmental and national security impacts have been adequately debated and addressed, and it's time to approve the pipeline and the estimated 42,100 jobs throughout the U.S. the unions say that it would create. Laborers Union President Terry O'Sullivan.
To the tens of thousands of men and women in the construction industry, this isn't just a pipeline. It's
their mortgages, college tuitions, car payments, and food on the table. And for our country, this isn't just a pipeline. It's a lifeline to family security, energy security, and national security. The American people want to build the pipeline. Just last week, an ABC Washington Post poll showed 65% of Americans support it, and 85% believe Keystone will create a significant number of jobs. It's time to wring the politics out of Keystone XL pipeline and to make a decision based on the will of the people and based on the national interest of our great country.
The Sierra Club, the Natural Resources Defense Council, National Nurses United, and some Canadian unions are among those opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline. They say, according to the U.S. State Department, the pipeline would create 6,500 temporary construction jobs at most, and they say, according to TransCanada, the company building the pipeline, only hundreds of permanent jobs will be left when the pipeline is finished. A Cornell University study also says the pipeline would allegedly kill more jobs than it would create by cutting investment in the clean energy economy. National Nurses United says that pipeline would accelerate unhealthy climate change. Progress Missouri recently delivered nearly 7,000 handwritten letters opposing anti-union legislation known as Right to Work to Missouri House Speaker Tim Jones. Progress Missouri Executive Director Sean Nicholson explains why the group opposes what it calls the Right to Work for Less legislation it says will harm working families.
We are fighting back on so-called right to work bills and on paycheck deception and other kinds of attack because we know that this is about the entire middle class in Missouri and the kind of state that we want for our families and for the future. We know that states with so-called right to work laws have lower wages, have lower rates of insurance, have lower investments in education, and that's not the kind of state that we want for Missouri.
Nearly 3 years ago, Connecticut was the first state to legally guarantee paid sick days for workers. A new report on the paid sick day law from the Center on Economic and Policy Research shows it had little or no negative impact on businesses in the state. Senior economist and report co-author Dr. Eileen Applebaum says the sick days law hasn't imposed major burdens on businesses. She says rather than the job killer opponents said it would be, over three-quarters of employers reported a positive experience with the law.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Minimum wage!
You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you? It's like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
Yeah, you can bet your bottom dollar on that. You can bet your last minimum wage dollar on that one. Interesting little development. The Louisiana legislature, the legislative sessions kicked off this week. Four of the legislators from Louisiana are pushing to raise the state's minimum wage. First time ever. Evidently, the state of Louisiana does not have a state minimum wage. They go to the federal minimum wage. So whatever the federal minimum wage is, that's where their money's at. Now, for me, I'm of the mindset, again, you know, you got to love the people who preach states' rights. I don't know why you'd want to depend on that. Anyway, now, what the four bills aim to do is obviously raise the minimum wage. The lowest one, the most gradual one, would obviously be $9 an hour by 2016. Personally, I think that will be exceeded by on the federal level. They're also talking about a $10.10 an hour one by the middle of next year. Here in Pennsylvania, you've got a gubernatorial candidate, Rob McCord, who's talking about $10.70 an hour almost immediately if he's elected. So there's something to look into. I don't know that $10.70 is possible, given the complexion of our General Assembly. I don't know that raising the minimum wage at all, given our Republican domination of our General Assembly here in Pennsylvania, is possible. It's going to take a lot of work from activists, from people like you and me, making phone calls, beating on doors. But here's the thing. What's it going to cost us? How much, what pound of flesh are we going to have to give up? That's the thing that gets me. And what we know about the minimum wage is we know, beyond exception, that all of the rhetoric that they keep trying to feed us is ludicrous. This idea, oh, it's a job killer. Well, you know, to be honest, the statistics of the past say it actually increases jobs. But I guess it's one of those things, you keep repeating it, and people maybe will buy it. I don't know. Yeah, here's the thing that bothers me, though. And this is one of those out of one side of our Republican friends, and a lot of Democrats on this issue, out of one side of their mouth, oh, we can't possibly raise wages. Business is under attack. They're overtaxed. All this nonsense. All the poor, poor companies. Saw a report today over at Bloomberg. The headline was, cash abroad rises. $206 billion as Apple to IBM avoid taxes. They have pointed out in the Bloomberg piece that these huge multinational corporations, they have sitting offshore because they're waiting for us to say, oh, you can repatriate it at a much lower tax rate, about $2 trillion outside the U.S., almost 12% increase from last year, according to the SEC filings of 306 corporations that were reviewed by Bloomberg. Three of the companies, Microsoft, Apple, and International Business Machines, IBM, added $37.5 billion, or 18% of the total increase. And you stop and you look at this stuff, and you look at these huge loopholes that we give to these big companies, and all of these tax advantages, and these gimmicks and these tricks where they offshore things, they put things into magic boxes. And you go, you know, my grandparents' generation, they understood you needed investment in education and roads and bridges and all of the things that we talk about here on the program. They understood that. And, you know, it would be nice if we could ever figure out where they got that revenue from, where that money came from. How did we do it? How did my parents' generation, how did they get to go to schools that were well-funded, where there were sports programs that were funded that you didn't have to pay for, that actually had insurance for the kids if they got hurt? How did they do that? It's one of the great mysteries, I guess, because obviously it wasn't by having a reasonable tax on corporate profits. It wasn't that. Could not have possibly been that, could it? Could it have been? Could it have been the fact that corporations paid their share? Could have been that? I don't know. But you look at all the number of the other companies. Look at Pfizer. Look at General Electric, Citigroup. You know, all of them part of these 307 companies who are just parking tons of cash. And they keep telling us, well, you know, if they could be more profitable, they'd create jobs. They haven't. And, you know, you look at a number of these outfits, and it just kind of makes you go, how much more are we going to be willing to put up with? And, you know, as the report pointed out, there are policies that actually provide incentives for what they call formerly U.S.-based companies, such as Activist PLC, or ACT, Endo International PLC, or ENDIB, and Eaton Corporation, who moved their headquarters out of the U.S., and of course got tax breaks for it. And now you find out that Chiquita Banana, the Chiquita brand, the international, they're based in North Carolina, they've announced that they're merging with another company, and that they're going to be moving where? To Ireland. Why? Well, they have no corporate tax. So now all of the profits that they make globally will not be taxed. And here's the difference. Here's the thing that gets me. You've got General Electric. $110 billion. They've got sitting over offset, untaxed, $110 billion. And we still give them tax breaks. In fact, we give them more tax breaks than they actually pay taxes. You got Microsoft, $76 billion parked overseas. Pfizer, the drug company. Merck, the drug company. $69 and $57 billion parked overseas. Apple, $55 billion parked overseas. And you got to start asking the question, at what point do we say enough is enough? And we change the law and say, you know, hey, fine. You do that, but we're still going to tax you anyway. Because understand, And this is where I think regulators and I think lawmakers have to wake up to the reality is, if you want to do business in this country, you've got to do it by the laws of our land. But I guess we're not going to. Now, is this a huge, huge problem? Are all the multinationals horrible? No, not really. As Bloomberg points out, the bulk of the offshore profits are held by just a handful of companies. In fact, 22 of them, according to the Bloomberg analysis, have more accumulated earnings outside the U.S. than the other 285 combined. So you've got, again, the big players, the big lobby money, the ones with the huge pockets, the monopolies almost that we've allowed to grow up around us, they're pushing this agenda. And I keep asking, you know, how much more are we going to be willing to put up with? What we've seen is we've seen this push, and it's really kind of both parties, but it's really the conservative ideology of no taxes. We don't have to pay taxes. Nobody should pay any taxes. There should be no taxes. No. But we want huge military. And, of course, we would like to have our kids educated, and we want roads that don't have potholes in it, and, of course, we want police departments and fire departments, and we want all these things. But we shouldn't have to pay for them. And I ask the question, how do you do that? You know, how are you going to get to the point to where you go, okay, we're gonna pay for what we need? Because they keep saying we need to pay our bills, right? And they're whining because we're broke, and we now see 22 of these companies sitting on the bulk of this almost $2 trillion they've parked offshore, not to mention the profits that they've been parking because, hey, you know, we've been given these incentives under the guise of you're going to create jobs, and what happens? No new jobs. Which, again, takes us back to the poverty situation. And I've said this before, and I will say it again because I think it's the right idea. Now, you go back to the good socialist days, to the good... of the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower. A massively high tax rate. I mean, I don't know anybody who's really advocating for a 92% individual tax rate and a corporate tax rate. I think it was like 50% at the time. Very, very high. I don't know that anybody's advocating that, but understand, nobody paid that. Because what they did back then, they said, we got this tax rate, it's way up here. We're going to incentivize things. We're going to have loopholes and tax dodges and all of these things for you to take advantage of. Point is, you got to take advantage of them. If you invest in your business, take advantage of it. You buy new equipment, take advantage of it. Pay your employees more, take advantage of it. Give them health care, pensions, take advantage of it. We're going to lower your rate. Stuff it in your pocket and then invest overseas. Should be met with mass anger, in my view. But what we've done is we've taken this idea of business friendly. And the Republicans love to tell us how business, open for business. Heard that nonsense a lot, haven't we? And then they cause chaos. Like the House Republicans did here in Pennsylvania today with House Bill 1154. Tilting the power into the hands of the corporate special interests. Look, corporations run this country. I don't know anyone now at this point, and I've been saying this for 9 years on the air, that we've given these companies way too much power. It's time to wrestle some of that back. We need the next Teddy Roosevelt. We need a decent Republican. We need a decent, he was a Republican. The whole conversion to a progressive, the Bull Moose Party and all that. We need that guy again. Bring him back. I'll bring the big stick, walk softly, do whatever you got to do, but we got to start breaking some of this stuff up. We've given these big multinationals way, way too much power. Because we almost can't regulate them anymore. That's how big and powerful they've gotten. They've gotten so out of control, in my view, that I don't know that our legal structure could possibly constrain them. They sometimes, when they get caught with their hand in the cookie jar, they'll pay a little fine. Sorry, we didn't mean to do it. Here's my hand. Go ahead. Slap, but not too hard. And they pay a little bit of fine. Nobody ever goes to jail. They want to be corporations, want to be people, but we never lock any of them up. Aren't you tired of that yet? Aren't you fed up with that yet? I know I am. And I'm looking for that next person to come in and say, you know what? Enough of this. Enough. And maybe it will be, maybe Democrats will grow a spine, maybe Republicans will have an epiphany. I don't know, but it's got to come sooner as opposed to later. Quick break, right back.
Controversial, thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
The counselor advised an informal setting, adding that it is, quote, an effective way to build a better relationship. That sounds like advice that a love counselor might offer to couples, but not so. This relationship is about money. The counselor is a lobbyist for the healthcare industry, and he was explaining the art of wooing Congress critters by paying several thousand bucks to spend a weekend with them at some posh resort in Vail, Key West, or other luxury getaway. By holding what are called destination fundraisers outside of Washington, lawmakers and lobbyists can spend quality time together as they ski, snorkel, and schmooze. It's a way to get some large chunks of a lawmaker's time, oozed the lobbyist, who had recently enjoyed 3 days at the Four Seasons Resort in Vail with five Republican House members, two of whom are on the committee that writes our health laws. But wait, wasn't there a big stink over golf junkets a few years ago, forcing Congress to prohibit lobbyists from paying for these back-alley affairs? Yes, but Washington believes that where there's a will, there's a workaround. Here's how this one works. The lawmakers' political committees pay for their travel, food, booze, and lodging, so these expenses, technically, are not gifts from lobbyists. In turn, the favor seekers come at their own expense, plus making legal donations to the members' re-election campaigns. The donations end up being three or four times the cost of the event, so the lawmakers pocket a nice wad of cash, while the lobbyists enjoy a weekend of making legislative whoopee. Since the donations and the event are considered, quote, separate transactions, it's all legal. See? This is Jim Hightower saying, neither do I. In fact, what I see is just another corrupt way for corporations to buy Congress. Who do they think they're fooling?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again. Because God is a Republican.
Yes. God's a Republican. And you give to the collection plate, won't you? Because, you know, we need a little bit more money. I don't know if you saw this story. It just blew my mind, to be honest. I knew this Joel Osteen guy. I don't know if you've seen this Osteen. A guy with that really kind of a cheesy used car salesman grin all the time. Like a mask, almost. Kind of reminds me of the Joker, but he's got this stadium-sized megachurch. I mean, it's this huge, giant place in Houston, Texas. This just massive place. I think it holds something like 16,000 people. Evidently, over the March 8th, March 9th weekend, just the money that people put into the buckets, not the stuff that they do electronically, none of the automatic donations from credit cards, none of the I pledge at the beginning of the year kind of stuff, just the money that people dropped into the buckets that they put around the 16. Can you imagine how long it takes to collect money in buckets from 16,000 people? And you got to kind of wonder. You wonder if, you've got this massive church. I mean, I'm really in the wrong gig. I should be a televangelist, or I should be one of these mega church people. And it's amazing to me the amount of money. According to the reports, and I don't know how true this is, but according to the report that I saw, just from those 2 days, the haul just in what people dropped into those buckets, $600,000 was stolen. Now people are worried about, our credit card might be in there. Who knows? Maybe they put their credit card information down. I don't know. And there's something wrong when the churches are taking credit cards. It's just a thought. But $600,000 for one weekend. I mean, stop and think about the amount of money that's coming into this gig. And, oh, by the way, did I mention tax-free? Yeah, isn't that nice? And we complain about General Electric. You want to talk about a gig. They're not quite sure who it is that stole the money. There's an investigation. And they're doing the whole prayer thing. Now, how I see this happening, how I see this coming around, they'll double that easy. Because, of course, they're the people who drop the money in the pot who are going to go, oh, well, that's a horrible thing. Someone stole it. We should double our contribution next week so that they can make it up. Evidently, this mega church brings in about 38,000 people every weekend. And then you've got all these people who watch on TV. I mean, that $600,000 was just people who sat in the seats. Those were just behinds in the seats. Those weren't the people watching on TV going, oh, yeah, I want to give you money. And, of course, we, the taxpayers, subsidize all that because it's all tax deductible. Think about that for a minute. And then you see these stories that come out of Washington. Then you see statements like Paul Ryan's. Then you see this whole push to punish the poor. Now, it was always my understanding, and again, I try not to talk too much about religion because everyone's got their own belief structure. I have mine. I'm sure you have yours. But one of the things I learned as a kid is you help the less fortunate. Now, there are those who say, oh, they do an awful lot of stuff, don't you know, Rick? Well, you know what? I'm of the mindset that it's not enough. When you look at the homelessness problem in this country, when you look at poverty in this country, when you look at the kids with whose parents can't afford to give them a brown paper bag, there's something wrong. And I look at the last couple of years, and this rhetorical vitriol, this chest-thumping, finger-pointing at blaming the poor. And I like playing the clip of Dave Reed, who the Republican Policy Committee chairman here in Pennsylvania, who said, it could be just one bad decision. And, I kind of remember my bad decision when I was poor. That being born thing was really just not a good decision on my part. Probably should have rethought that. Should have picked door number 3, maybe. Like you've got a choice in that. But what we've seen the last couple of years is a lot of anger towards poor people. And what I find interesting is you look at all of this talk about religious freedom. And I'm the first one who will tell you I believe people should have the right to believe whatever they want. And that's not just being generous, it's reality. Believe what you want, but just don't impose it on me. Yet we have groups of faith-based people who tell you they believe, but they believe that they have the right to impose their rights upon you. As the old man always told me, you've got the right to do whatever you want until your rights infringe upon mine. Or, as Justice Black said, you have the right to flail your arms around until your fist touches the tip of my nose. I find it interesting that one of the key arguments by the conservative right wing of this country is that somehow their religious rights are being infringed upon or trampled on because same-sex couples want to have equal rights as everyone else. Because I don't want to have to be inundated with their message every time I walk into a public building or every time I go to a park. That somehow having access to contraception so that we can cut down on the number of unwanted pregnancies so we don't have as many abortions, somehow that is infringing on their rights. And I look at these things and I say, well, you know what? You don't have to take birth control. No one told you you had to. You don't have to marry someone of the same sex. No one said you had to. But you do have to be a decent human being and treat people with some measure of dignity and respect. And if you want to do business in this country, you cannot discriminate against people because of their race, their ethnicity, their orientation. You're in business. You provide a service. And this is where I think we really need to go back to the founding idea of the country. And this is where I think a lot of our business leaders seem to forget that we used to have a charter system in this country. You had to go get a charter. And it was a difficult thing to get. And one of the first things on that charter is, what public good are you bringing to society? What are you bringing that's good to the community? Discrimination, I would argue, not very good. But I find it interesting that my religious friends are willing to, because it's their right, their religious right, they're willing to forego everyone else's civil rights. And then justifying discrimination, justifying exploitation. It's very interesting to me. And then somehow pointing the finger at the homeless and the poverty-stricken as if somehow it was their fault. It leaves me scratching my head sometimes. Now, I look at this report put out by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. They pointed out that the Section 8 vouchers, the government-funded rent rebates, whatever you want to call them, has reduced the number of low-income families with children who are homeless or living in shelters or living on the streets by over 75% from the years 2000 to 2004. This was the Bush years, and you got to give him credit because they actually did some decent things on homelessness. In essence, what they did is they cut the number of families without a home by almost 80%, which is a huge thing. Now, what happens? Well, ScrewQuester pops in. And ScrewQuester comes around, cuts more than $2 billion just in 2013 alone. And then what do we have? Well, you've got some 70,000 more folks who now have no help. And what do you get? Well, homelessness on the rise. Is that a good thing? I don't think so. I think it's a horrible thing. But it's what... Oh, it's only 2%, Rick. We could easily afford 2% across, but it wouldn't hurt anybody. Except for these 70,000 families who are now on the streets. And you know, you go through and you look at all of this stuff and you go, priorities? Really screwed up. And maybe we should be talking about this kind of stuff in the light of maybe how do we fix it? And I'm beating up on Paul Ryan simply for the reason that maybe this wakes him up. Maybe he realized, maybe, and I doubt it, maybe he wakes up and goes, boy, that was really a dumb thing for me to say. Maybe I really need to start thinking in a different way. I doubt it, but there's always hope, isn't there? Let's take a quick break right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. More working people. Come to talk.
Right.
The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. North America's building trades unions are urging immediate approval of the Keystone XL pipeline project. They say environmental and national security impacts have been adequately debated and addressed, and it's time to approve the pipeline and the estimated 42,100 jobs throughout the U.S. the unions say that it would create. Laborers Union President Terry O'Sullivan.
To the tens of thousands of men and women in the construction industry, this isn't just a pipeline. It's their mortgages, college tuitions, car payments, and food on the table. And for our country, this isn't just a pipeline. It's a lifeline to family security, energy security, and national security. The American people want to build the pipeline. Just last week, an ABC Washington Post poll showed 65% of Americans support it, and 85% believe Keystone will create a significant number of jobs. It's time to wring the politics out of Keystone XL pipeline and to make a decision based on the will of the people and based on the national interest of our great country.
The Sierra Club, the Natural Resources Defense Council, National Nurses United, and some Canadian unions are among those opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline. They say, according to the U.S. State Department, the pipeline would create 6,500 temporary construction jobs at most, and they say, according to TransCanada, the company building the pipeline, only hundreds of permanent jobs will be left when the pipeline is finished. A Cornell University study also says the pipeline would allegedly kill more jobs than it would create by cutting investment in the clean energy economy. National Nurses United says that pipeline would accelerate unhealthy climate change. Progress Missouri recently delivered nearly 7,000 handwritten letters opposing anti-union legislation known as Right to Work to Missouri House Speaker Tim Jones. Progress Missouri Executive Director Sean Nicholson explains why the group opposes what it calls the Right to Work for Less legislation it says will harm working families.
We are fighting back on so-called right to work bills and on paycheck deception and other kinds of attacks because we know that this is about the entire middle class in Missouri and the kind of state that we want for our families and for the future. We know that states with so-called right to work laws have lower wages, have lower rates of insurance, have lower investments in education, and that's not the kind of state that we want for Missouri.
Nearly 3 years ago, Connecticut was the first state to legally guarantee paid sick days for workers. A new report on the paid sick day law from the Center on Economic and Policy Research shows it had little or no negative impact on businesses in the state. Senior economist and report co-author Dr. Eileen Applebaum says the sick days law hasn't imposed major burdens on businesses. She says rather than the job killer opponents said it would be, over three-quarters of employers reported a positive experience with the law.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So the president, yes, going to be using the pen. And today was a day when he decided to break out said pen. Republicans not happy. Business-friendly folk not happy. Here to talk a little bit about that and other things going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much.
So he broke out the pen, did he?
That's right. Well, I think the pen is actually, you're talking about this whole issue of employment and that. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's about time that somebody
did
something.
Yeah, it's actually going to happen tomorrow.
Good.
He announced it today, but the pen is actually coming out tomorrow.
Oh, see, I was hoping the pen was already there. Because, look, it's about damn time. I mean, we haven't revamped our labor laws.
Oh, it's definitely about time.
And sometime, and, you know, look, if you're going to get nothing out of Congress, you got to do what you got to do. I know people who have been working as low-level management people for years and have been abused and used and all of this stuff, and in a lot of cases aren't even really making close to minimum wage.
That's right. And what's essentially happening is that you have people who are working like dogs, and because of the kind of money that supposedly they're making, they don't have to be paid any overtime.
Yeah. Well, but remember, Alan, and this is what one of my friends told me, who I asked, you know, why would you put yourself in that? Why would you allow yourself to be exploited like that? Why go do something else? But here's the response, and you'll love it. Here it comes. But I'm management.
Right. And therefore, they take no responsibility.
And, you know, I'm going, but what has that got to do with you not being able to feed your family? I mean, what we've done in this country masterfully is we've conned people, and I think it's my grandparents' generation's fault, really, because I've talked about this often, that, you know, when I was getting to be working age, my grandfather said, if you drive a truck for a living, you'll be a failure. Because he wanted to, you know, he worked his behind off. He, you know, he worked all those years shoveling coal off the back of a coal truck, and you name it, he did it. He didn't want his kids and his grandkids doing what he had to do, which I understand. You know, he wanted the kids to be, you know, with the white shirt and the tie and pointing, you go do that, go do that. But, you know, the reality is, you know, when I, for the last 20 years, driving a truck was a pretty good living. And I think what we've done is we've conned people into believing that those jobs, those aren't good jobs. Those aren't jobs that people would want, and they shouldn't be able to afford to support a family.
Well, you know something interesting? I mean, Russia's obviously top of the hit parade with the Ukraine issues, but during communism, in fact, truck drivers were the biggest, most important jobs you could get because they went from city to city, which means that people got information from them. They got goods, but the truck drivers were the one group of people that knew what was going on in the country.
Yeah. Yeah, there's another thing that you could throw on that. Now, look, I understand that, you know, my grandfather didn't want his kids to have to go through what he went through, but I think they projected that as if you end up doing this, you're going to be a failure. And I think that being enamored with being part of management or having a title always played first to, can I make a living?
Right, and what the pen, as you call it, is going to do, hopefully, is to change some of that. But that does happen tomorrow.
Good. Well, you know, I've often wondered why, you know, I know during, like, the auto companies had management unions where they had representatives and associations, not unions under the NLRB model, but they had representatives and that. And I've often wondered why management never really pushed for that.
Unclear. For
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, unclear. Let's move along. You brought up the Ukraine. What's going on?
So the prime minister from Ukraine was at the White House today. The White House has been very, very clear by saying that this Sunday vote that is supposed to happen about the Crimea and whether they're going to secede or be part of Kiev was not an acceptable vote, not a vote that would be allowed, essentially,
right,
or recognized is a better word. And so that is going to happen. I mean, there is going to be some discussion about that. Senator McCain is taking a bipartisan group of senators to Ukraine to have a discussion with everybody about what is going on. So that is happening, and they are leaving tonight, so they're expected to be in Ukraine tomorrow.
Well, that ought to be interesting. I wonder what kind of drums they brought with them.
Yeah, I don't know. I do know that no matter what, we do know that if they have this balloting on Sunday about a referendum as whether they want to stay or not, we know, as I think I might have said to you, but that they printed more, almost double the amount of ballots that there are people. Now, why would they need that?
Well, because somebody might have to change their mind.
Exactly.
You know, when they've got that clear acrylic box and the white piece of paper with the big red marker that you've got to put the X on, whether you want to go with the Russian Federation or leave blank when you put it in the box, you might have to change that.
Right. So this is what going to be a lot of the focus, I would say, about Senator McCain and the rest of the senators' trip.
So Kerry's position in this, where's Kerry at in all of this?
Well, he obviously goes with the administration, and they're objecting vigorously to the vote that's happening on Sunday. Secretary Kerry is also very focused on the European Union and Ukraine. And one of the things the European Union is doing is they are eliminating tariffs on goods from Ukraine to encourage a better financial deal with Ukraine.
Yeah, let me ask you about something else. I've been hearing the right, a lot of folks on the right saying, well, you know, if we were drilling more, if we got that Keystone pipeline through and we were doing more drilling and we could sell natural, we could sell the gas to the Ukrainians, that would be good for them too. How much of that is BS, do you think? I think it's total BS. In fact,
well,
I think
it has to be BS because they don't have the money to do it.
But if we gave them the money and then got it back.
But that's kind of like what we do with foreign aid, right?
Yeah. But I love this, the rhetoric, though, that if we just built the pipeline, everything would stop.
Exactly. Well, right. Not going to happen.
Yeah, or if we sold them, if we did away with the rule that we don't export so much of the gas out of the country, that would automatically overnight end all of our problems.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, well, it's not going to happen anyway. So Kerry, I guess, testified about the state of the world today?
Well, he did. I mean, this was sort of an oversight budget hearing to talk about the budget. He talked about places that are near and dear to my heart, such as South Sudan, and the fact that there is quite a bit going on in the world in places other than Ukraine that are very, very important to us strategically, but that, you know, people are overlooking them. And he also talked about North Korea not being nuclear and to make sure that they don't get any weapons because they're so insane. Just like Kim Jong-un got, 100% of the vote?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and I told my wife that, and she goes, well, geez, how'd you get 100% of the vote? I go, well, when someone puts a gun to your head, you generally get a much higher percentage of the vote that way.
Exactly.
When you're willing to throw your own uncle to a pack of wolves or pack of dogs, generally people go, I don't want to be that guy.
Right. Exactly.
It's a horror. So I mean, really, honestly, truthfully, if we're going to be that world cop, if we're going to be that person who jumps from country to country to country, start making a list of places that we're going to be sending our resources, our money, and our citizens, because it is a lengthy list.
Oh right, and that is exactly what Kerry faces. That it is a very unstable world, and Ukraine is one area. It's not just South Sudan. It's also, which, of course, I just came back from, but it's the Central African Republic. It's Congo. That whole neck of the woods in Africa is very unstable. And it's important that gets stable because, if not, it breeds terrorism. And I always remind people that Osama bin Laden lived in North Sudan for 7 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, and I often talk to people. I say, you know, when we went across this country, we went into places that I thought were like third world nations. I cannot imagine the poverty, the despair, the situation in places like where you've been in the South Sudan, and how things get done. I mean, I don't know that most people's minds can take them there.
Right.
So I give you nothing but the utmost credit for working your heart and your soul out and your body as well. For helping folks in those places.
Well, you know something, I always like to say I get more than I give.
I hope so, because I give you credit.
I do. I love the people there, and I also like the weather. I don't like freezing.
No, okay, I'll give you that, but I don't like being shot.
No. As my friend Jim Pinkerton from Fox says, medicine and goats are no contest with an AK-47. I agree with that.
Yeah. So Sebelius was testifying before the House Ways and Means Committee today?
Yes, and she said that she thinks that premiums may go up a slight bit. And then she was asked about the whole issue of how many people have signed up, and she basically said, this isn't Medicare or Medicaid. It's not a government program. It's a private program. It's done by private insurance companies, so we don't actually have those numbers.
And are they entitled to those numbers, I guess, is the other. Since it is subsidized by we, the taxpayers, don't they have to know how many people are getting these plans?
I'm sure that at the end of the year or every 6 months, there's probably a provision. I haven't read that part of the law where they have to report. But right now, I mean, you know, don't forget, the Republican Congress wants a week-by-week report. That's what they've been asking for.
Well, of course, because they want to make it as difficult as possible and put as many hoops and obstacles in front of her so that she's not actually out there doing bad, funny, or die videos.
Exactly.
Did you see that?
By the way, what did they have, 11 million because of that video yesterday?
And it was bad. I mean, I really, did you watch it?
Well, you know, we have a new theory about this.
Hit me.
And that is, you're younger than me, but that boomers and late Xers, I don't know if you're a late Xer, you're not a boomer.
No, I'm not a boomer.
But boomers and late Xers don't think there's a darn thing funny about it.
Okay.
The young people think it's hysterical.
Okay, good. As long, because that was the target audience. So as long as you're getting some feedback that they think it was funny,
they all think it's hilarious. All of our staff, they just were talking about it and talking about. I watched it. I said, how could you find anything funny about this?
Because the guy who's the supposed comedian, I missed it. It must be the generational thing.
It's totally generational.
George Carlin, he definitely is not.
And no, but you know what? They think it's very, very funny. I looked at it and I said, what?
Yeah, it was. My problem was it was slow. For a generation that's supposed to be short attention span theater, supposed to be, very, very short-minded, the whole video was very slow, a lot of lulls and a lot of points where you're going, okay, come on, I know where this is going, move it along.
Exactly.
I guess that was my problem. But, you know, I got to be honest. You know, the numbers seem to be going in the right direction, though. And you know,
the numbers are going in the right direction, and they had more sign-ups because of this video, which I just think is crazy. Yeah. But, you know, what can I say?
It worked. Hey, people buy bottled water. I still can't figure that out.
Well,
when I was a kid, somehow
think it's safer.
When I was a kid, there was a drinking fountain everywhere. You don't see drinking fountains anywhere.
That's true.
And that was a nice job by the business community.
Now, there is a place to buy bottled water. That would be South Sudan, but that's a different story.
Yeah, well, exactly. But, I mean, we've been told that public water is no good.
I drink tap water. I drink tap.
Well, so do I. But, you know, we've been sold as a society that must be better because it comes from Coke or comes from Nestle. And what could be better than Coke or Nestle? So let's get to the race in Florida. What were your thoughts on the loss by Alex Sink?
Well, Alex Sink lost by 1.9 percentage point. And today, actually, she got a call from Steve Israel, who's head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and was basically asked, stay in the race, run again in November. We think you're going to win.
Good. There's a step in the right direction. Do you think it was a referendum on health care?
I don't know. I think, you know, all politics is local and things are very complicated. It's very easy to say this is a bellwether election for the future. I'm not sure it is.
Yeah. I think I rarely agree. I shouldn't say rarely, but I don't agree often with Ed Schultz. But I did see he said that Democrats have got to stop running away from Obamacare, and I've been saying that for a while. They've got to own up to it. It's ours. It is what it is. We're signing up millions of people. It's at the lowest rate of uninsured in years. It's working. Instead of against the idea of we're going to fix whatever's wrong, and I think you have to fix it when it comes up. But we don't even know what's wrong yet.
We don't. But hopefully we'll find that out soon.
No, hopefully nothing will be wrong. It'll be a healthcare paradise. Okay, you're not going there with me, are you?
Yeah, no. Right. I'm not going to go there.
Fine. I guess lastly, big explosion in Harlem, huh?
Big explosion in Harlem, and it's interesting because I'm putting this together with the talk that the transportation secretary gave to a lot of transportation executives in Washington on Monday, where he said our infrastructure problem in this country was like having termites in the basement, which just waiting for it to fall apart. And, you know, again, we don't know exactly the cause of the explosion. We know it's probably gas, but is it that the gas lines were older. What I am going to say is we have an infrastructure problem in this country.
No kidding. I mean, in Harrisburg, they've had, last time I checked, 42 sinkholes in the last year. And the vast majority of them are just, as you've pointed out, a crumbling infrastructure. The sewer lines haven't been replaced in 120 years. And you wonder, you know, at some point, you know, the usefulness. And the one guy was explaining how they used to do sewer lines in the old days with brick and this other kind of stuff. And they go, hey, we haven't used that technology in 100 years. Yet that's what's under the streets in Harrisburg. And they just keep paving over. And eventually it just all erodes away and boop. Sinkhole.
Exactly. I mean, if you build a hotel in this country, now what you do is you have a regular maintenance schedule that also involves at some point you change the decor in the rooms, et cetera, et cetera. But we've never done that. We just built it and we didn't do anything.
No. Well, you know, we keep talking about it. We'll do it in the future. Don't worry about it. We'll get to it, Ellen. We'll get to it after it swallows up your garbage truck.
Right, or has an explosion.
Sad stuff. Alan, great talking with you. Appreciate the time.
Thank you so much.
Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. More working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Craig Harrington. Top Senate Democrats and members of the Senate Climate Action Task Force held the floor Monday for an all-night talkathon to push congressional action on climate change. America's Newsroom co-host Martha McCallum suggested that there are more important issues than climate change.
You know, you look at some of the major issues that we're dealing with right now, and I know that you feel strongly about global warming and that you feel it's an important issue. The only reason, you know, I'm going at it is because I don't understand why they're not actually having the guts to put out legislation there and to vote on it and to see what happens from it.
Since Republicans gained control of the House majority in 2010, most climate legislation has been dead on arrival. Despite Fox's dismissal of the urgency of addressing climate change, The Guardian reported that studies show climate change is already damaging the global economy. And economist Dean Baker, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, explained that climate change will have much greater costs to the future than government debt. For more on climate change and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been discussing how America eventually adopted the color code of red for Republicans and blue for Democrats. International politics used red to designate liberal and blue to signify conservative. But Civil War mapmakers used blue for the liberal rebels and red for the Union conservatives. Then the Grover Cleveland and William Henry Harrison campaigns used red for Democrats and blue for conservatives. And into the early parts of the 1900s, Texas helped Spanish speakers by using blue for Democrats and red for Republicans. In the 1908 presidential race, the New York Times published a color-coded map using blue for Democrats and yellow for Republicans. And the Washington Post published one using blue for Democrats, red for Republicans, and yellow for undecided. The confusion continued until a technology came along that demanded consistency. Join us again next time for the Game Changer. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
Thank you. The National Labor Relations Act was a New Deal initiative which helped save American capitalism by creating a process which would protect the rights of employees and employers. This was before NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, which tore legal rights for workers apart, moved millions of jobs out of the U.S. Yes, we stand for the workers at Boeing in Washington State, but we also stand for the workers at Boeing in South Carolina, because they will have no recourse if Boeing wants to move jobs to China. You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. Take away workers' rights to free speech, take away workers' rights to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America. Hey!
This is a battle cry for the common people.
absolutely, positively. I'm waiting for it, and I'm hoping, I got to be honest, I'm hoping this latest bit by our friends in the Republican Party, and some Democrats, too. I mean, there had to be a couple of Democrats that threw their name into this House Bill 1154 that, on its face, sounds, oh, well, you would, a reasonable person, well, you know, we want to make sure that no one is stalked. Has nothing to do with that. Has everything to do with silencing one's ability to protest. And, you know, it's amazing to me how willing we are to give that up. How willing we are to give up our rights. And I go back to the whole Patriot Act thing. And it's amazing to me at how easy that was. And how simple it was for the Republicans and some Democrats who didn't want to appear to be weak. They didn't want to appear to be weak. Nope, can't have that because, you know, that would be bad. And if we appeared to be weak, then, you know, we might lose our election. And you know, I look at this and I just sit back and go, you know, at some point, I hope that we gain a pair of a set of you-know-whats at some point. As they continue to take these things away, that generations fought, bled, died for, that we just seem to go, oh, well, you know, it's something we needed in the old days. We're much more sophisticated than that now. Employers are so much more benevolent today. We don't have any of those problems. You know what we've got? We've got falling incomes. We've got rising number of hours that people are working. In fact, you know, we're one of the highest, probably the highest hours per week countries in the world. But we love to work. Don't you know that, Rick? We're more working people. Yeah, I like how they keep telling us that. I do. And I like how they keep telling us that, you know we can't have any of those socialist laws. That would be bad. Like family medical leave insurance. Back May 5th, or March 5th, the New York State Assembly, they passed family medical leave insurance bill, a family leave insurance bill, 88-40 in the New York Assembly. It's going to give people the ability to, if they get sick or if a family member needs help or, you know, whatever that leave is going to be. It's going to be good for the economy. It's going to be good for business. It's going to be good for families. But the right wing, man, they're going nuts, ballistic, losing their mind. How dare they? That's not business friendly. Business friendly is China. Business friendly is Vietnam. Business friendly is you have no rights. That's business friendly. And I guess the question we've got to ask ourselves in the next days, in the weeks, in the months ahead, as the ugliness continues, because since this is one of the dominoes. The next one is the paycheck destruction, and then comes right to work for nothing. And then we might as well be Mississippi, where they will make it illegal for you to talk to your neighbors. It's coming. Absolutely coming. I want to thank you all for being here tonight. If you have any questions, comments, something on your mind, you can always email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Also, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get our podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone, all of that. Thanks for being here. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial, mysterious, infernal.